You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, Christopher Simpson on the media's coverage of war and peace, and Kathy Kelly on the state of U.S. empire and imperialism. They will both be speaking at No War 2016, a conference being organized in Washington, D.C. You can go to worldbeyondwar.org to sign up to attend or to find out how to watch the live stream at home. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Chris Simpson. Christopher Simpson is a professor of journalism at American University. He's known internationally for his expertise in propaganda, democracy, and media theory and practice. He has won national awards for investigative reporting, historical writing, and literature. His books include Blowback, The Splendid Blonde Beast, Science of Coercion, National Security Directives of the Reagan and Bush Administrations, Universities and Empire, Comfort Women Speak, and War Crimes of the Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank. Simpson's work has been translated into more than a dozen languages, and Chris Simpson will be speaking at the upcoming No War 2016 conference, which you can find and sign up to attend or watch the live stream at worldbeyondwar.org. Chris Simpson, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
You'll be doing this panel together with Gareth Porter and Sam Husseini under the banner of Remaking the Mass Media for Peace. What's wrong with the mass media as it is for peace, and what do we need to do about it?
Well, that's a complex question. I'm really looking forward to this panel. I think Sam and Gareth are great speakers and have very interesting things to say, and a lot of experience in this area, too. So I think it'll be a great panel. There's no quick or easy answer to remaking the media for peace or, for that matter, anything else. What we are able to do at this stage is to identify the problem more clearly. And part of the problem is that the media reproduces itself, so to speak, from generation to generation, from year to year. And it does that by reinforcing some of the attitudes and myths that are built into our society and our culture. That's part of their business plan. That's part of how they stay in business. So one part of the answer to remaking the media is to find ways to break its present cycle of self-reproduction.
And what are those myths that are being reproduced, and how do they generate good business for media companies?
Well, my guess is that your listeners are well aware the myth of manifest destiny, the myth of American exceptionalism, the myth that the United States is supposed to save the world and that any sort of war crime or crime against humanity that is committed during saving the world is therefore justified. The myth that a essentially infinite arms budget actually contributes to security, either in terms of relations among nations or even security of day-to-day life in many parts of the world. So those are just the ones that occur to me off the top of my head. There's quite a number of others.
And these
myths interconnect and tend to reinforce each other, so that you have whole candidacies for president, at least in my view, from both parties that rely heavily on these myths. They're both major parties I'm referring to.
Yes, of course. When you talk about the United States, you know, saving the entire world, I'm reminded this week I've been reading about U.S. military threats to defend U.S. troops in Syria against Syrian aggression against U.S. troops who have invaded Syria. Is that a storyline that could happen in the media of any other country on Earth other than the United States?
That's an interesting question. I think that there are other countries where that type of storyline or narrative, as it's sometimes called, could be successful. And Russia, for example, that type of narrative is used very fairly frequently. China. Occasionally, it's the same sort of thing.
Russia and China have troops in foreign countries that have illegally invaded and are making war in those foreign countries, and then they accuse the foreign country of aggression when it...
Yes. Well, certainly that's happened historically. There really is no doubt about that. And in the present circumstance Ukraine, there's quite a complicated situation in which... there are indeed Russian troops that are officially denied, but nevertheless actually there. In the Chinese case...
Do you mean in Crimea or in other parts?
Well, in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine.
In Crimea, they're not officially or otherwise denied. They're openly there under a treaty that pre-exists the military coup that never shows up in the U.S. media, as we're told that, the Russians invaded Crimea.
Well, I get your point, and I do agree with you to the extent that there are numerous... this propaganda battles back and forth between big powers and even among small powers from time to time. In the specifics of the Crimean case, the legalities of Russian occupation of Crimea are at best questionable. I feel that there was a more peaceful way to reconcile Russian interests in that region than sending in troops. I think that if the United States had moved into Crimea in that sense, or the United States had moved into, let's say, Nicaragua, or backed proxy troops in Nicaragua in that sense, then the peace movement in the United States would understand perfectly well that it was aggression.
I opposed Russia sending in more troops to Crimea at the time, but it had troops there under a treaty that allowed more troops in. You were dealing with a military coup government in Ukraine that was, immediately cracking down on, speaking the Russian language and so forth, and the people of Crimea voted to rejoin Russia. I can't imagine a popular vote in Nicaragua where the people vote to rejoin the United States, which Nicaragua had been a part of for centuries. It doesn't seem like the same case to me.
No, it's not identical. You're right. It is not identical. We can argue this longer if you think it's really in the interest of your listeners or the goals that we're both trying to reach. But the point that I'm trying to make I'm not ashamed to admit, is that there is more than one imperial power on the planet today, and that is a serious problem for everybody concerned. One of the problems of this type of the 21st century type of imperialism is that aggressive moves are blamed on somebody else. That's what you see with the incident that you raised in the Syrian case. You see other incidents of the same sorts in other parts of the world. That doesn't mean that other powers, say, for example, the United States in the Syrian case, have a license to send in troops or to try to reorder the situation in their own interest. It does suggest that the way forward in that kind of situation, where there's a multipolar world and where multiple countries are perpetrating aggressive acts, is that some form of international law is the only way forward to stabilize those types of conflicts.
What do you make of the growth of independent media, online media, the use of international and small and new media? I mean, it seems that young people, in some cases, who are turning to new media are much better informed than older people, have almost exact opposite views of Israel-Palestine, for example, in the United States along generational lines. Are they going to stick with good media and we're going to have better politics, or are they going to grow old and switch to bad media and bad opinions? How does that work?
Well, I think it's great when independent democratic media emerges. I support that. And I think that to the extent that that is available, I think it's a wonderful resource. That said, the media, I don't think it's easy to predict exactly what people are going to do in the present. Say, for example, in the contest between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I think that Trump surprised an awful lot of people and an awful lot of liberals in particular with his naked appeals to racism, and that could enlist, if you will, enough people to vote for that sort of thing, that he became the presidential candidate for that particular party. So there's a struggle over media. There's a struggle over how we reproduce society from year to year and from generation to generation. Media plays an important role in that. There's a lot of people out there, for example, Institute for Public Accuracy, and FAIR, Center for Democracy and Media, and Media and Democracy, rather, and many other groups. So those are just a few that come to mind, that are working on breaking the link between big money interests, between big military interests, and so forth, on the one hand, and the content of media on the other. They challenge particularly mainstream media, and they do a good job of it too. But will they succeed? Well, that remains to be seen. This is a long struggle. It's not. I think there are people out there who say, "Oh, well, because there's the internet, therefore, we will automatically, or at least nearly automatically, move into this utopian situation where there's a sharing economy and peace will reign and so forth." I don't think that is at all guaranteed. I think that there's a very difficult time ahead, and that concerns me a lot, frankly. But the right thing to do, the encouraging thing to do, the exciting thing to do, is to enter into that struggle and have an effect on it.
Well, it is an enormous project, and we could talk about it for hours, and we fortunately will have a chance to talk about it at greater length at the upcoming conference that people can find at worldbeyondwar.org, where Chris Simpson will be speaking together with Sam Husseini and Gareth Porter on this topic. Christopher Simpson, thank you for your books and the work you do and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Kathy Kelly. She doesn't need a long introduction, known to all of you as one of our leading peace activists with her organization Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She is doing great peace work all around the world, and she will be speaking at No War 2016, the conference being organized by World Beyond War. Go to worldbeyondwar.org. Kathy Kelly, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and I'm certainly looking forward to the World Beyond War conference as well.
I am looking forward to seeing you and everybody else there. One of the leading architects, as many describe him, of modern U.S. imperialism has sort of kind of said, forget it, we aren't going to dominate the whole world after all. Do I have that right?
The sort of kind of is important. You know, Brzezinski is certainly somebody with a long, long history of advocating wars. It's so interesting in his article, which appears in the American Interest, it was actually an April 2016 article, he gives a list of consequences of war and pillage dating back to the 16th century. Now, obviously, it's a selective list. But you get the idea that here's somebody who's really sick and tired of war. But I don't know that he's necessarily sick and tired of controlling other people's lands and other people's resources to suit U.S. interests. It's just that it seems at this point, realistically, he is convinced that the U.S. cannot any longer be the unipolar controller, that sun is setting. And so as a sort of fallback, the U.S. should make a new coalition, a new alignment with China and Russia. Now, it's important that in that effort, he clearly doesn't think that military strategies are the top drawer ways to form a new coalition. So I think he would be against the poking toward a new Cold War that the U.S. has done on the borders of Russia and with the Diaoyu Islands in offshore China. But he doesn't necessarily want to replace the U.S. attitude that other countries should subordinate themselves to serve U.S. interests. So I have a lot of hesitation about that article being celebrated as a tilt toward an end to Brzezinski's advocacy for war and dominance. I think it's a new form of dominance. But we should definitely pay close attention and come right up and say, that's right, war doesn't work. We need completely non-lethal means. We need to say to the weapons people, now it's your turn to retire and make new things that people could use and stop pushing Japan and certainly China and Russia and other countries into continuing to use war as the means to solve problems.
So Brzezinski is not about to join the Afghan peace volunteers, but he does seem to have made some sort of a shift, right? This is the guy that is usually credited with having admitted to U.S. operations way back in the 70s to seeking to pull the Soviet Union into a disastrous war in Afghanistan.
And he was so unrepentant. At one point he said, what's to regret? He acknowledges, we pulled the Soviets into Afghanistan. Why should I be sorry? I don't know if he's sorry now or not, but I sure wish that he would read the article that the New York Times recently published on Bamyan, a province in Afghanistan where women farmers form an incredibly brave union to say, look, we're going to make our land work better for us. And they start to plant a variety of crops. And David, you were over with the Afghan peace volunteers and Hakim, and Hakim was just about run out of town in the Bamyan province because he had strongly made the suggestion that a variety of crops might be planted, and some of the young people had started to do that. Well, now the women are doing it, and they're planting a variety of different potato crops, and they're slowly, slowly making gains on survival. Well, this is the kind of thing that the United States could have been working toward all along. Right now, if you were to calculate the plots of land devoted to growing poppy in Afghanistan, it would be equivalent, and this is according to the Secretary, John Sopko, the fellow in charge of the Iraq reconstruction plan, the supervisor. He said that that amount of land would equal 440,000 United States football fields, including the end zones. So under the United States invasion, occupation, surge, and dumping of billions and billions of dollars into both the military and non-military spending, Afghanistan has become anarcho-state in which the poppy production is hopelessly entangled into the government, into everyday life, into their economy. But here are some women in Afghanistan, in the Bamiyan province. They're Hazara women, the most discriminated against group, trying their best to help their children survive. Could the U.S. be supporting that kind of thing rather than continuing to line the pockets of all of these various weapon-making companies that are experimenting with all kinds of aerial surveillance and aerostat-tethered blimps and different ways to do targeted assassination in Afghanistan? Certainly we could, but it takes just a dogged, persistent effort on the part of regular, ordinary U.S. people to say, we want to continue citizen-to-citizen diplomacy. We'll go over and find out what the people in Russia think about going to war. We'll try to report on the consequences of war by going over to visit the Afghan peace volunteers. And we'll keep on holding walks and vigils and demonstrations to oppose the militarism in this country.
Well, I'm looking forward on the International Day of Peace, September 21st, to being on a call with, I hope you, and with the Afghan peace volunteers about alternatives to war that people can listen to on live stream. And I'll get a link up on my website, and I imagine on yours, vcnv.org. I think, Kathy, it may have been Gorbachev. It was some Russian several years ago now who said the United States has made all the mistakes the Soviet Union made in Afghanistan and moved on to inventing new ones. That seems to be the case. And Brzezinski, it was several years ago now, I heard speak on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and Brzezinski proposed some numbered list, maybe a dozen things that needed to be done in Afghanistan. And number one, which he said we would just touch on briefly because it wasn't controversial at all, was, of course, to continue the war in Afghanistan. And somewhere down the list, like number 8 or 9, was build an oil pipeline through Afghanistan. That's a very important to have that in the list. And I questioned him about both, starting with the first one. And I said, the polls are absolutely 50-50 on get out or stay in Afghanistan, as they were at that time. It's the definition of controversial. How can you say there's no controversy over stay in Afghanistan? I mean, that seems to be who that guy was. I don't know if it's who he still is.
Well, I think the audience that he thinks counts are certainly the 1%, a very small elite group, and unfortunately they do manipulate tremendous control. It's so interesting to me that on the 21st, these kids over in Afghanistan, I shouldn't say kids, they're growing up now, and there are many of them.
Yeah, they're not youth anymore, right?
How does that happen? But they're arranging to have a connection with someone from each of the 34 provinces, conscious that the country is a very, very young country. 65% of the people living there are under 21 years of age, and they see a future for themselves in overcoming the divisions and the fighting that have gone on so relentlessly. But, you know, how many weapons have poured into that country, compliments of the United States? I mean, you know, you hear about every soldier who is trained, you know, take care of your rifle, memorize the serial number, have that rifle polished. Well, 1.4 million rifles have gone missing in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that's why people can arm themselves to the teeth and get involved in gun battles so easily, because there's, you know, such desperation. And the same thing, I think, continues to rip Iraq apart. And it's really been instructive for me to stay in touch with Peace News, the peace newspaper produced in the United Kingdom, which is quite popular in Europe, maybe not so easily read here. But Milan Rai has two articles in their latest edition which talk about the Chilco inquiry and show that what the United States and Britain both wanted in Iraq was essentially Saddamism without Saddam. They wanted a military strong man, or we probably would be saying a strong man in that case, or they wanted some kind of a grouping that wouldn't at all be involved in creating democracy, but instead be able to get the country under control, but without them having to deal with any of Saddam's resistance to U.S. control. And I think that that may be what Brzezinski would see as desirable, to be able to find some new means of something like empire, a Sino-Russo-U.S. control, using sort of second-string states such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United States can start to get more control over how they use all the weapons we sell them. Turkey and other strong-arm states. And so I think the hope in different people worldwide who don't want that vision, who don't want to support that, linking up with one another, becomes very, very important. And that's why World Beyond War is so important.
And Afghan Peace Volunteers and Voices for Creative Nonviolence, the number of guns is an incredible number. People imagine these places like Afghanistan as just inherently violent, not realizing that the weaponry comes from the United States. But the other number you said, that so many are under 21, is also remarkable, because this particular war is coming up on 15 years. Someone who's 21 would have been 6 when it started. These are people who haven't known peace at all, have they?
No, and it is, again, remarkable that the young people we've gotten to know are so willing to try to experiment with something that's alternative to being trained how to use weapons or being signed up and enlisted in somebody's security forces or somebody's military forces. And I think, Alfred McCoy's research has been so, so important for showing what those alternatives could look like in terms of agriculture. And that's why I'm so impressed with the women in Bamiyan. I mean, the answer, it seems to me, for Afghanistan's future is not to make it a user-friendly country through which to build that pipeline you mentioned, or in which to develop mining that could pull rare earth minerals out of the ground, but rather to develop the agriculture. And Alfred McCoy had said some years back, it's not a recent report, and it's too difficult, he told me, to really try to create an up-to-date report, but about 6 years ago, he wrote that it would cost $34 billion to restore the agricultural infrastructure of Afghanistan. And, of course, $34 billion seems staggering, doesn't it? But if you just count what they've spent on their retrograde mission pulling the United States weapons out of Afghanistan, they at one point were predicting $7 billion just to melt down all the tanks. Now, I think they sent some of those tanks to the U.S. police departments instead. But another $25 billion to ship all of the United States equipment and troops back to the United States. Well, that's $32 billion right there. It could just about accomplish what Alfred McCoy had said would be needed to, clear out the irrigation systems, to plant saplings in orchards and new orchards all along the denuded mountainside, and to replenish the flocks. And so,
yeah, it's a wonderful idea, Kathy. And with the U.S. Army not being able to account for $6.5 trillion, I think they could find $39 billion if they wanted to. I really look forward to hearing more about this and about your recent trip to Russia and other work for peace at Washington at No War 2016. People can go to worldbeyondwar.org to sign up to come or to catch the live stream of that. Thank you for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a federal prosecutor in Brazil determined that the bookkeeping maneuver with which twice-elected President Dilma Rousseff had been charged by her right-wing opposition did not constitute a crime. Rousseff's congressional opponents include a number of people themselves facing charges, including bribery, electoral fraud, kidnapping, and homicide. Then, Rousseff was impeached. Many Brazilians are calling it a coup, but the official U.S. position is what now? We'll hear about what's happening in Brazil from Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Also on the show, after Kevin Moore filmed Baltimore police dragging Freddie Gray into a van, he says police came to arrest him with assault weapons and helicopters. Released without charges, Moore said months later, police sit outside his son's school and ride past him, taunting him with their phones up. Citizen journalists collecting evidence of violence and abuse by law enforcement are literally providing the content for a social movement. So why are they being harassed and jailed and ignored while corporate journalists collect awards for their work? We'll talk about the importance of legal and journalistic defense of civilian journalists with Shahid Buttar, Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. In the scandal of the half hour, anyway, Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson, when asked in an MSNBC interview what he would do about the battle raging over the Syrian city of Aleppo, responded, quote, "What is Aleppo?" close quote. Well, the New York Times saw a story in a candidate who is unaware of one of the main battlefields in one of the world's deadliest conflicts. The paper's Alan Rappaport wrote a September 8th story about the gaffe. But as FAIR contributor Ben Norton noted in a piece for Salon, that story described Aleppo as the de facto capital of the Islamic State, or ISIS. That's wrong. The de facto capital of ISIS is Raqqa, a city halfway across Syria from Aleppo. This was then changed in an edit to describe Aleppo as a stronghold of the Islamic State. That's also wrong. The main rebel faction in Aleppo is Jabhat al-Nusra, better known as the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, a bitter rival of ISIS. ISIS itself has little presence in the city. The New York Times ran a correction on its misidentification of Aleppo, but Norton says then they had to run a correction on the correction because the first correction misidentified Aleppo as the capital of Syria. The actual capital of Syria is Damascus. It seems unlikely that Gary Johnson will be president in November. The New York Times, however, will likely continue to be the country's most influential newspaper. Much of that influence derives from the Times' ability to declare what the serious center is politically and who is relegated to the dismissible margins. You saw that power exercised in a September 4th Times report on British politics by Stephen Erlanger. The story focused on Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, or its left-wing leader, Jeremy Corbyn, as the paper has it. The point of the piece is to blame Corbyn for the fact that, quote, the Labour Party is in shambles. Its leader and its members of parliament are in a virtual civil war, and it is deeply unpopular with the broader electorate, close quote. Well, Labour's unpopularity is easy to exaggerate. Its projected national share of the vote in the last local elections, held in May 2016, was 31%, a percentage point ahead of the Conservatives. This is considered unpromising, as opposition parties that are soon to become governing parties generally do better than that. But it's an improvement over May 2015, 4 months before Corbyn assumed leadership, when Labour trailed by 6 percentage points. Corbyn's responsibility for Labour's woes, though, is taken for granted by the Times because he's just too far left. Quote, Mr. Corbyn, a man of the hard left who also wants to renationalize the utilities and make Britain non-nuclear, is deeply skeptical of the United States and considers NATO an outdated aggressive alliance. First elected to Parliament in 1983, Mr. Corbyn has always been on Labour's fringe. He supported Hugo Chavez. The leftist Venezuelan strongman has pushed hard for more spending for the poor and has been a persistent critic of Israel and supporter of Palestinian statehood. Close quote. Well, the thing is, some of those hard left positions are widely popular in the UK. A 2013 poll, for example, found 68% of UK voters in favor of nationalizing energy companies and 66% supporting railroad nationalization. When recognition of Palestinian statehood was considered by the UN in 2011, a BBC poll found 53% of Britons in favor, only 26% opposed. As for pushing for more spending for the poor, given a choice between labor should offer more for people in poverty and labor should offer more for people on middle incomes, in a poll sponsored by the Trades Union Congress, 44% of UK citizens picked the former versus 29% choosing the latter. The British public is more mixed on the UK's nuclear force, with 51% expressing support for the nation's submarine warheads in an ORB poll and 49% advocating scrapping them. We couldn't find any polling on how the British public felt about Corbyn's attitude toward Hugo Chavez, perhaps because no one thought that this was an issue particularly vital for the UK electorate. It's probably true that Corbyn is more skeptical of the US and NATO than the average Brit. But it's impossible to avoid the impression that certain positions are identified as problematic, not because they're unpopular with Corbyn's constituents, but just because they're unpopular with the New York Times. And finally, as of September 8th, the broadcast news networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, have aired exactly one report on the Dakota Access Pipeline protests since the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe began an encampment against the project in April, according to a search of the Nexus News database. That report aired on the CBS Morning News at 4 a.m. on September 5th. Here it is in its entirety. Quote, National Public Radio reports violence during demonstrations against a proposed oil pipeline in North Dakota. Protesters confronted workers Saturday at a construction site. Police say four private security guards and two guard dogs were hurt. Tribal officials say the construction destroyed an Indian burial ground and cultural sites. Close quote. While those 48 words are a one-sided retelling of an NPR report, Dakota Access Pipeline Protests in North Dakota Turned Violent, which in turn got most of its information, as well as its anti-protester spin, from an AP story, Oil Pipeline Protest Turns Violent in North Dakota. But the report on NPR's website also contains video footage from Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, who, unlike anyone at the Big Three networks, thought that the largest mobilization of indigenous activists against environmental degradation was worth some original reporting. Democracy Now!'s footage shows the construction project's security guards wielding pepper spray and deploying attack dogs to provoke and injure demonstrators. Violence on the part of the pipeline authorities that was left out of CBS's Rip and Read. Also missing from what is so far all of broadcast TV News' coverage of the Dakota Access protest was any mention of the threat the pipeline poses to water resources. The pipeline crosses the Missouri River just a half mile north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Or the climate destruction facilitated by pipelines designed to ship fracked oil out to consumers. But if you're only going to give a story 48 words at 4 o'clock on one morning, there's only so much you can say. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A crawler at the top of the New York Times website announced breaking news. Dilma Rousseff, accused of misconduct as president, has been impeached, ending the power struggle consuming Brazil. That sounds like an unlikely outcome, even to those who haven't been able to follow all the twists and turns of events in Brazil. But what accounts for the difference between those who see something being resolved in recent political events and those who see something being violated? Joining us now to help sort through things is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, can you help us understand, especially the last few steps? Because the last I heard was that a court had said that the charges against Dilma Rousseff were not impeachable. And I also seem to remember hearing that Michel Temer wasn't going to be able to hold office for 8 years. So what happened just recently to bring us to this moment?
The prosecutor, the federal prosecutor who was in charge of the case, decided that what she was being impeached for, this financial maneuver, was not a crime. So that's, I think, very important. And most people don't know that. In fact, most people probably think that she was impeached for something having to do with corruption. But the Senate voted to remove her from office anyway on August 29th. And, of course, that isn't going to settle the question. As for Temer, who takes over as president, he's been banned by the courts from running for office again for the next 8 years. But he doesn't stop him from finishing this 2 years of Dilma's term. So that's where it stands right now. But there's already been big protests, people demanding new elections because nobody likes Temer. And a lot of people see it as a coup.
Well, that's my understanding. And I'm wondering how, you know, you can get to a place where it sounds like this was a political process working itself out legitimately. And I think one element of that was brought up by Glenn Greenwald on Democracy Now. He said that Brazilian media were playing up the idea that, you know, impeachment is part of the democratic process. That's a thing they do in America and in Europe, and without sort of making the distinction that in the United States, for example, if a president is impeached, the vice president takes over, not the opposition party.
Yes, well, the vice president did take over, but he is also with a big opposition party. So it was a coalition government. The Workers' Party won the presidency, but they don't control the Congress. So basically, this is the right really taking over and trying to reverse the results of the last three elections. I mean, there is some similarity to the United States in the sense, if you remember the Clinton impeachment, I think right. That was obviously a political move, and ultimately it didn't prevail. They actually at least had a couple of crimes. I think that's the difference, or at least alleged crimes. They had obstruction of justice and perjury, and they tried to make it into an impeachable offense, and the Senate decided it wasn't. And here, you know, it is a little more outrageous in Brazil because they didn't really even have a crime. And you did see some criticism of it from the first the head of the Organization of American States, who was a very staunch U.S. ally, nonetheless criticized it, and so did the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, but that's from the OAS also, their independent body. They criticized it too. But in Washington, you had absolutely no criticism at all from NGOs and human rights groups. And in fact, Human Rights Watch, America's Watch Division, the head of that, Jose Miguel Vivanco, actually was quoted in the Brazilian press on the day of the impeachment and praised the democratic process in Brazil and seemed to be very supportive of it.
Is there a sense that there's some reflection of the popular will going on here, apart from what's happening in terms of the political processes? I mean, it is fair to characterize the Brazilian public as unhappy in general terms.
There was a reflection of popular will in terms of, you know, there's a deep recession and Dilma was unpopular.
Right.
But on the other hand, nobody wanted Temer to take over. So there was a big call for new elections, and that's what a lot of people are demanding now. And very few people want this right-wing government that's going to try and reverse the social and economic progress of the last 14 years. The Workers' Party did do pretty well until just 2 years ago. They had reduced poverty by 55% and extreme poverty by 65% and doubled the minimum wage in real terms. And this government came in, they said they're going to double down on the austerity, and they got rid of the Ministry for Women and Human Rights, and they appointed a cabinet of all white men. So this is really the biggest change without an election since the 1964 coup that brought in the military dictatorship. So I think that's why I don't think it's over yet. I mean, people are definitely going to resist this. And it's unfortunate the United States played such a negative role in the whole thing. That part was really completely ignored in the U.S. press.
What should we know about the role that the U.S. in fact played, and what should we be looking out for down the road?
Yes, well, we won't know everything for probably a long time, if ever, but we do know, first of all, that on August 5th, John Kerry, Secretary of State, went there and did a joint press conference with the acting foreign minister, José Serra, of Brazil, and they praised the new relationship that the United States was going to have with Brazil. And so it was a real strong statement of support without saying we support the coup, because after all, this wasn't even the elected government he was dealing with. This is not a normal protocol for him to do. He should have waited till at least it was decided that Dilma was going to be permanently removed from office, even if you think the impeachment process is legitimate, which, as I said, most people didn't. He still didn't have to do that. And that was really a very strong message that they supported this coup. And there was another one prior to that, back in April, just 3 days after the lower house of the Brazilian Congress voted to impeach Dilma. You had a meeting between the number three official in the State Department, Tom Shannon, who's also the former U.S. ambassador to Brazil and the one likely making these decisions and what to do about the coup. He met with one of the leaders of the impeachment, Senator Aloysio Nunes from the Brazilian Senate. And this was another and a very early signal, very strong signal that the U.S. was on their side, because, again, he didn't have to have that meeting. They weren't going to meet with, say, Dilma, for example. That's the way that they took sides and let everybody know that the U.S. was on the side of this impeachment or coup.
Let me just ask you, finally, what were other possible ways forward, and are they still possible?
Yeah, I think that this government's going to be very unpopular. The demand for new elections is going to increase. But if that doesn't happen, I think you'll have 2 years, and then the Workers' Party will come back. Former President Lula da Silva has already pretty much indicated he's going to run. He's popular in the polls. According to the polls now, he would win if the election were held today. So I don't think it's over because, again, you know, this is a real right-wing thing that's going on. This is not what the Brazilian people voted for in the last three elections.
We've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Find their work online at CPERT.net. Mark Weisbrot, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
If the expression, "I can't breathe," holds power for you, it's because of Ramsey Orta. He's the one who held his cell phone camera steady while New York police officer Daniel Pantaleo choked the life out of Eric Garner in July of 2014. Garner was Orta's friend. He used to give Orta's daughter a dollar to spend at the local store every time they walked past. Ramsey Orta's been sentenced to 4 years in prison, stemming from drug and weapon charges, those that stuck among the many and various police have brought against him since the Garner video came to light. Chris Ledet uploaded video of Alton Sterling's killing at the hands of Baton Rouge police. Reporting to work the next day, he was arrested, handcuffed, and shackled by civilian and military officers. First, he fit a description. Then it was assault charges that didn't exist. Finally, it was unpaid traffic tickets. Diamond Reynolds, who filmed the killing of her partner, Philando Castile, handcuffed and held in jail for 8 hours, separately from her 4-year-old daughter. If you're seeing a frightening pattern here, you're doing more than most mainstream journalists. The targeting of citizen journalists for retaliation by law enforcement would present concerns enough for freedom of speech and for the rights of communities to maintain their own safety, were it not matched with a disheartening absence of support from a media establishment that has premised thousands of stories on their world-changing work. Joining us now to talk about what protections exist for civilian journalists and what more may be needed is Shahid Buttar. He's director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Shahid Buttar.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
The expression kill the messenger comes to mind, or at least fail to support, much less celebrate the messenger to the extent that they're not sure they'd do the same thing again. First of all, regular people who film police actions are on the right side of the law as it exists, aren't they?
Absolutely. The First Amendment unambiguously protects the right to observe and record police activities. And the failure of police departments and agents and officers around the country to respect those rights, and similarly the failure of the journalistic profession, I think, generally to stand in solidarity with those rights, that is to say, the right of the press, which does not make a distinction between professional and grassroots journalists, is alarming. And I think this is one of the places where the rubber hits the road in terms of the words in the Constitution and the rights they aim to protect, that being the rubber hitting the road of social practice, and in this case is public safety agencies that perceive any threat to their own political power as analogous to a threat to public safety. And that exactly, of course, is precisely gets the relationship wrong, because the people who are capturing police violence on video, they are the ones enhancing public safety here, as well as standing behind very well-settled law that unfortunately the agencies and unfortunately a lot of journalists choose to disregard.
Well, let's take a little bit of a look at the legal underpinning there. We do have records on the book that support this right, as you've said, but then something happened. What was it that happened in April in Philadelphia that seemed to perhaps throw some of this into question?
Yeah, there was a district court, U.S. district court in Philadelphia, that held for the first time that the First Amendment did not unambiguously protect the right to record police activities. And in that case, the judge invented a novel standard and then failed to apply it, deciding that the First Amendment only protects the right to record police if the person recording the police is overtly hostile to them, which is preposterous because literally that decision would invite violence, which of course is the first thing the law is supposed to stop or, you know, replace, as it were. And so it's, you know, the decision would force people who are recording police to announce their hostility in order to gain First Amendment protection, which is basically like asking people to invite getting beaten up or arrested in order to then have a right to go to court. It's preposterous, and it completely inverts transparency, the role of the judiciary. It turns a blind eye to systemic police violence. It's almost like the judiciary giving the middle finger to communities of color that have endured arbitrary police violence for 400 years and are now sparking a discourse around it because of the transparency enabled by cell phones and their use to record police departments. Interestingly enough, this case is absolutely an aberration, and it is being appealed to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where I expect, you know, a modicum of sanity to reemerge and rein in that decision and reestablish the well-settled rule that the First Amendment right of the press, if not the 14th Amendment right to equal protection under the laws, or for that matter, the Fifth Amendment right to due process, that the right to record police activities is constitutionally protected.
Well, and you're making very clear that it isn't as if we're talking about a mere legal abstraction. And of course, the context is we're talking about vulnerable people and communities who have this almost accidentally democratic tool or technology that they can use to get some hope of awareness for things that they've lived with forever. And that kind of brings me to the journalistic point. Activist and writer Josmar Trujillo wrote that, you know, these cop watchers are not only willing and able to do work that reporters, mainstream reporters, either won't or to some degree can't do. They're looking at issues of policing that impact communities of color the most, and it matters that they are oftentimes of these communities. They have also insights that matter. And what Josmar was saying was it's not enough to simply say they should be allowed to film. You know, we really do have to be outraged collectively when they are harassed. And he made the point that for an individual cop watcher, having police arrest you and take your phone and erase your footage, it's like if you raided the offices of CNN, you know, and destroyed their files and their equipment. And we should see a commensurate response from journalists.
I absolutely agree. The only criticism I'd have in some respects is that the concern proves too much. I mean, the journalistic profession has been taking it on the chin at the hands of the government for decades. And, you know, to watch the ranks of journalists sort of fail to internalize that attack is disappointing. I mean, I go back to the Justice Department monitoring the cell phones of AP journalists in Washington, right? Or the repeated attempts to force reporters to divulge their sources in the context of investigations of national security leaks. Or, for that matter, the vilification of whistleblowers, which is no different. I mean, across all of these contexts, what we are talking about is criminalizing transparency to protect illegitimate uses of power. And that, of course, is what the Constitution is supposed to stop, right? It's, we're supposed to be committed as a country to transparency and to reining in arbitrary power, but we actually, in each of these situations, whether it's criminalizing and persecuting whistleblowers for revealing fraud, waste, and abuse or lies by executive officials, or whether it's jailing grassroots journalists who are recording the police departments in their communities using arbitrary violence to, in some cases, kill people extrajudicially without ever proving guilt of any offense at all, let alone a serious one, while, and I'll just throw in an added gloss here, you know, this is at the same time, mind you, that senior executive officials do lie about grave issues of global importance and get away with it. So we have hyper-persecutory, relentless, violent so-called justice for the powerless. We have permissive, blind eye, you know, no modicum of justice for the powerful, and the transparency that the citizen journalists are providing, I should say civilian journalists, because in a lot of cases, you know, people with cell phones include undocumented people who are recording ways in which all of our constitutional rights are being violated. It's a profound public service done by these journalists, and I dare say that the authoritarian hammer has already fallen in lots of arenas, and I dare say that the clarion call to journalists to take seriously the threat to transparency, that was sounded years ago. What we see in the arbitrary arrest and the co-optation of some judges in this paradigm of suppressing transparency and reports of police violence, I think, is the escalation of that clarion call, and I do hope very much that journalists take it upon themselves as a profession to challenge the suppression of transparency in whatever form it might emerge.
We've been speaking with Shahid Buttar, Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Find them online at EFF.org. Shahid Buttar, thanks very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio Eco Shock. I'm your persistent collector of voices, Alex Smith. 10 years ago, when I began broadcasting this program, my goal and my passion was to save humanity and the creatures from dangerous climate change. I would do it by presenting proven facts, as published by science, with illumination from authors and the example of brave activists. All that failed. We are still in a car hurtling towards the cliff of a terrible shift in climate. We are still debating whether to take our foot off the accelerator, much less hit the brakes. That is because we are addicted not just to fossil fuels, but to energy slaves. All of us. Me too. The most experienced scientists, even the heads of most governments, know we are headed into dangerous climate disruption. I wondered what the only world body formed to address this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, would do. It turns out that body just held an introductory meeting in Geneva this past August. It's a scoping meeting, laying out the groundwork for a report due out in 2018. The subject? The grave risks of a world 1.5 degrees hotter than the days before we began this mass industrial experiment. As you'll hear, we have already breached that danger line of 1.5, at least for part of 2016. This week we'll hear from two of the top-level scientists advising governments via the IPCC. These are the big-picture experts who assess extreme weather events. And as we'll talk about next week, there are plenty of extreme events happening around the world. What to tell the children? Later in this program, we'll also spend a few minutes eavesdropping on what Australian desert birds tell their embryos inside the egg. That prepares them for hotter times. But first this. From pole to pole, science is reporting more climate change faster than expected. How can this be communicated to governments and to the people so we have a hope to avert the most dangerous climate shift? We've reached two experts at the top of that process. Later we'll talk with Catherine Mack. She's just attended the latest Geneva meeting on a climate 1.5 degrees centigrade hotter than the pre-industrial era and beyond. But first, let's talk with Dr. Chris Field. Since the mid-1980s, he's founded and led the Stanford University-based Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology. Dr. Field is internationally recognized for his role as co-chair of Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Among other things, that group led to the IPCC 2012 Special Report on Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. In the space where scientists advise governments, Chris Field is an expert's expert. Dr. Field, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
As I watch the news, Chris, and new climate science, it's my impression climate change is arriving harder and sooner than scientists expected. How do earlier forecasts by the IPCC fit with what is happening now?
I think there's strong evidence that we are seeing impacts of climate changes that have already occurred. Some of these are occurring sooner than projections, but the pattern we're seeing is also very consistent with a climate that's being pushed consistently by human emissions of heat-trapping gases. The new thing that's really shaped our understanding in the last few years is understanding the way that climate change plays out in terms of altering the profile of risk. What we're seeing is the changes that have already occurred alter the odds of impacts that really influence people, ecosystems, and economies. It's not that every person in every location is impacted, but there's a greater probability that things go wrong, that there's flooding, fire, heat waves, and that those impacts are adding up around the world.
So tell us a little bit about the IPCC report on the risks of extreme events and what we see now.
Back in 2008, several countries asked the IPCC to take a careful look at the relationship between climate change and risk of extreme events. Extremes are kind of a sharp end of the climate stick. It's where things really break and where harms really occur. And as I indicated, what we're seeing is a clear pattern that climate changes that have already occurred have altered the risks of many kinds of extremes. Extremes of high temperature, extremes associated with heavy precipitation, and extremes that depend on high sea level, where storm surge or a spring tide is on top of a high sea level. This pattern of changes have already occurred has resulted in altered odds of impacts around the world. We don't know that every extreme has been associated with climate change, but we're seeing a clear pattern of more and more events that are consistent with climate change. And we've also seen the emergence of a really dramatically new kind of science where we can, for individual events, attribute the change in odds of that event occurring to the climate changes that have already occurred. And we've seen that many events, especially high temperature events over the last few decades, are really clearly associated with climate changes that have already occurred.
I was pretty impressed with the rainfall they got in Louisiana, 4 months of rain overnight. And so what you're saying, that the chances of that being, say, not a 1 in 1,000-year event, but maybe it'll happen more often. Is that what we're saying?
That's exactly right. The specific change in the probability of a heavy rainfall event like the one we saw in Louisiana has not been analyzed in detail. But in general, we know that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. And around the world, we've seen a larger and larger proportion of the rainfall falling in the heaviest events. So these kinds of very heavy storms that aren't necessarily associated with a greater annual rainfall, but with more of the rainfall falling in a concentrated period, are getting to be increasingly common, and they're exactly what we expect in a warmer atmosphere.
You know, almost 10 years ago, I talked with Dr. Joe Rome, and he's a former advisor in the Clinton administration and later a famous climate journalist at his blog Climate Progress. And Joe said we still had time for action because the atmosphere was only warming by about 0.1 degree per decade. Now, almost 10 years later, it looks like we've gone up 0.1 degree just this year alone in 2016. Maybe it'll go down a bit next year. Maybe it was El Nino. But have we already touched on the 1.5 degree danger zone laid out in the Paris Agreement?
If you look back at the formulation of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, what it says is that the goal of the convention is to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. I think the most recent IPCC reports have clearly shown that we're seeing dangerous anthropogenic interference in real impacts on real people. 1.5 is an important point in the trajectory because it really represents an amount of climate change where we can identify a whole range of impacts that become increasingly serious. On the other hand, we also know that we're seeing impacts now. The way I think about it is that the risks increase rapidly with the amount of warming, and 1.5 represents some very clear increments to the level of danger. 2 represents additional increments. 2.1 represents increments beyond that, and there are profound advantages to limiting the amount of warming as much as we possibly can. In 2016, for the first 3 months, the global average temperature was already 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial for the first 3 months of any year. So we're already flirting with that level. It may be that the temperature cools back as a result of internal variability, but we're definitely very close to that 1.5 number. It's also important to remember that 1.5 isn't any kind of a magical guardrail or threshold. We're already seeing danger. We need to be investing in coping as effectively as possible with the risks that we already face. And the more warming we see, the more we're going to have to invest in dealing appropriately with climate change risks.
You know, that's something that really worries me, that we might have a couple of colder winters in the Northern Hemisphere, so the public starts to doubt global warming and all deniers say it's not happening. And, you know, Dr. Hansen is among a group of scientists who say this could happen, at least in the UK and Northern Europe, due to meltwaters from Greenland deflecting the Gulf Stream. What do you think of Hansen's most recent paper and the chances that a short-term cold weather event could happen?
It's useful to step back a little bit and ask about the amount of internal variability in the climate system and how that compares with the amount of warming that we're seeing on a year-by-year basis. We know that there is lots of variability, and that variability can amount to a tenth of a degree here and a tenth of a degree there. It's sufficient to mean that over any period of a few years, we might not see any warming, we might see cooling. But if you look over the string of decades, it's clear that we're seeing profound warming. Whether or not we might see cooling in some parts of the Earth system as a consequence of changes in the pattern of the winds or in the distribution of sea ice is an active area of research. And it highlights a general pattern, which is that in a rapidly changing climate, we should expect surprises. And even though we understand a vast amount of the fundamental physics of the way greenhouse gases are changing the climate, we don't understand all the details.
Do you think that goal of 1.5 degrees C warming is still possible?
When we talk about aggressive actions to tackle climate change, it's important to remember that there are profound risks from a changing climate, but there are also important risks from changing the energy system so rapidly that the prospects for hundreds of millions of people in the developing world are really put in jeopardy. Energy access is a key component of sustainable development. And we want to make sure when we think about a sustainable future that we're investing not only in protecting the climate, but also in protecting the access to development for the world's poor. So the question of, is it possible to limit warming to 1.5? The answer is clearly yes. We could shut off the global energy system tomorrow, and we would limit warming to less than 1.5. But that wouldn't be an attractive option. That would foreclose on legitimate aspirations of people around the world. What we need to do is figure out how rapidly we can decrease emissions, transition to a sustainable energy system that continues to provide energy access, at the same time it's not causing climate change. Doing that in a way that limits warming to 1.5 or less is absolutely at the limit of what could be accomplished. It might not be possible, but it's worth a serious effort.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Chris Field. He's a leading American scientist at Stanford University and in projects by the United Nations IPCC. Chris, is it true that all the intergovernmental panel pathways at or below 2 degrees of warming assume humans will employ carbon capture and storage, a technology that hasn't worked yet on any meaningful scale?
It's very difficult to figure out what set of technologies and in what relative proportions will address the climate problem. The analysis to date says that it's likely to be the lowest cost approach if we use a diversity of solutions, and that includes renewable energy from wind and solar, if we look at carbon capture and storage, and if we at least consider the possibility of using nuclear energy. Anytime you push options off the table, you tend to increase the risk in the remaining portfolio, you increase the likely costs. Carbon capture and storage is deployed very widely now. It's deployed mostly in enhanced oil and gas recovery, but we know that large quantities of CO2 can be injected into geologic formations and stay there. There's been a lot of discussion about a set of technologies that are often called negative emissions, and these involve growing biomass, using that to generate power and capturing the CO2 and injecting that. That involves combining two technologies that haven't been combined before, biomass energy and carbon capture and storage. The real issue with biomass energy with carbon capture and storage isn't so much whether or not the pieces of the technology work, it's whether there is sufficient growing land to produce the biomass in a way that doesn't impact biological diversity, doesn't impact food security, and doesn't impact livelihoods of the poor.
Right. I've been reading about that as blue carbon is one of those pathways.
The Earth system, the land and the ocean, remarkably productive and support amazing diversity of different life forms. including life forms in the ocean. And we know that many of these life forms are good at removing CO2 from the atmosphere and converting into biomass. And one of the things we're beginning to look more and more at is how we might modulate the various ecosystems so that we can store more carbon. Taking areas that used to have forests and restoring forests is a wonderful way to produce negative emissions. And there's been an increasing amount of focus recently asking whether there are parts of the ocean where we might do that as well, including coastal regions. And we know, for example, that most of the world's mangrove ecosystems have already been lost. If we could restore mangrove ecosystems, we could sequester a substantial amount of carbon, not enough to remove the pressure on addressing industrial emissions, but we could store significant amounts and make ecosystems a part of the solution.
Well, as you know, the Arctic is heating faster than anywhere on Earth, and that means ice melt, changes in ocean heating, methane from the seabed maybe, permafrost melt for sure, to name just a few worries. How seriously do you take threats from the Arctic?
We know that over the last many decades, the Earth system has provided a tremendous free subsidy to humans' emissions of heat-trapping gases. For every ton of CO2 that's released to the atmosphere, about half of it is taken up currently by the oceans and by ecosystems on land. That's an amazing free subsidy. We also know that in the warmer future, we may see some of the processes that have removed carbon from the atmosphere begin to release it. And the Arctic is one of the areas of greatest concern, partly because the Arctic is, as expected, warming much more rapidly than the rest of the planet, and also because very large quantities of carbon are stored, frozen in permafrost soils, especially in eastern Siberia. The carbon that's frozen in these soils has been described as frozen broccoli, in the sense that once it's thawed, it decomposes very rapidly. We don't have a good sense for how rapidly permafrost areas might thaw as a consequence of warming, but we know that with more warming, they're much more likely to thaw than with less warming.
All right, I'd like to read you a short paragraph from the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report released in 2014. It says, while the scope of the challenge is generally understood in the scientific and a growing policy and practitioner community, much of the public is still unaware of the enormity of the challenges involved in responding to and mitigating climate change. End quote. How could we tell them? What politician or media outlet, Chris Field, will systematically and persistently persuade the public we have to consume less and use far less energy?
If we look around the world, what we've seen in the last several years is really remarkable progress in confronting the magnitude and importance of the climate challenge. The 2014 agreement between the U.S. and China, incredibly important in breaking a logjam for countries to come together. And, of course, the Paris Agreement in December of 2015 is a real landmark in essentially all countries of the world agreeing that they need to come together aggressively to address the climate challenge. The issue now isn't so much countries recognizing that this is important. It's having countries make the kind of commitments to reduce emissions at the same time they're building sustainable energy systems. We're seeing meaningful progress around the world, but what we need to see is an increase in ambition so that that progress is accelerated.
You know, from emails, I can tell that some of my listeners are frustrated with the slow pace of science and government. The much-needed report on the danger of exceeding 1.5 degrees C that we'll be talking about with Catherine doesn't come out until 2018. An assessment of how governments are reaching, or more likely not reaching, their promises at Paris is set for 2023. That seems a ways away. Chris Field, is the process going slower than the climate is changing?
Yes, the process is going slower than the climate is changing, and there's a profound need for the world community, individual countries, individual citizens to realize that they can contribute more to solutions. I would say that the really dramatic change in understanding over the last year is partly a recognition that this is a problem we can solve, but it also was partly a recognition that there are real co-benefits, that aggressive investments in solving the climate challenge can also at the same time build robust economies and vibrant communities. Taking advantage of that creates huge opportunities for private companies, creates huge opportunities for subnational actors, for states and cities, and for individuals. Individuals can do a huge amount. They can do a lot through their consumption choices, through the way they vote, through the way they make investments. Companies can make a huge difference through the kinds of products they offer, through the kinds of policies they advocate for. And cities and states can make a huge difference.
You know, the IPCC doesn't have a world headquarters or a huge one with full-time scientists measuring climate and impacts in real time. That's what I'd like to see. Do you think we need a different institution, that people that are working on it all the time, full-time?
The world's fortunate to have tens of thousands of investigators really dedicated themselves to understanding the challenge of climate change and the opportunities for solutions. And that extends far beyond the academic community. It extends into governments and into private companies. There are lots and lots of mechanisms by which knowledge about climate change is assembled, and the IPCC is an important actor in that. The IPCC is uniquely qualified to provide definitive information about what we know and what we don't know in consultation with governments. But the IPCC is only one of many actors in this space, and it's important, especially in this era where we're driving towards solutions, that we recognize the importance of inputs from other kinds of actors, corporate actors, other sources of climate change assessments, from public pressure groups. And the IPCC plays a unique and critical role, but it's not fair to the world system, and it's not fair to the scientific community to ask the IPCC to do everything about creating solutions.
I see your point. So in all this, what is the role of the Carnegie Department of Global Ecology, where you work?
In my department, my own lab, we're dedicated to providing basic information about the way that climate change impacts ecosystems, about the way feedbacks from ecosystems, things like thawing permafrost, impact the climate system and alter the profile of risk, and about the kinds of solutions that individuals, companies, and governments can undertake, and the way those can contribute to solving what's really the defining challenge of our era.
Chris Field, are there other things you would like to add or talk about?
I think the really important thing for people to recognize now is that the climate challenge is at its core, one we can solve, and we can solve it in a way that creates a broad range of benefits beyond simply decreasing the amount of climate change that occurs. But we need to really tackle the challenge boldly, recognizing that standard ways of doing business, standard conversations about the role of individuals, companies, and countries really need to change. And if we tackle those challenges boldly and we see them as opportunities rather than as liabilities, tackling climate change can really be the entry point to a brighter future.
I have to say, though, wrapping it up, that I see hard and turbulent times ahead for my kids and grandkids because of this challenge of climate change. Would you disagree?
I would say that we're at a threshold. And if we ignore the challenge of climate over the next few decades, it's going to be really hard to come up with solutions that are compelling and rich with opportunity. Right now, we have a window of opportunity where it's not that the impacts of climate change can all be avoided, but they could be managed in a way that points us toward a better world. I'm concerned that the world will move too slowly to act at this moment of opportunity. But if it does, I really see addressing the climate challenge as an important step for building a more sustainable, brighter future.
I hope you're right. From California, we've been speaking to a world climate science leader, Dr. Chris Field, from the Carnegie Institution Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Dr. Field is widely published in Science and has been an essential part of reports by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Chris Field, thank you for your years of dedication and for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
EcoShock.
From Stanford University in California, we're going to talk with one of the new generation of scientists already launched into the upper stratosphere of climate study and negotiations. Catherine Mack is a senior research associate at the Carnegie Sciences Department of Global Ecology at Stanford. Her CV says, and I'll quote it here, "For the past 5 years, Dr. Mack co-directed the scientific activities of Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which focuses on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. This work culminated in the IPCC's fifth assessment report and its special report on managing the risks of extreme events and disasters to advance climate change adaptation," end quote. Well, that's huge. Catherine, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to talk with you.
We all hope scientists will be able to translate the big risks of climate disruption to world leaders. We hope there will be a plan that will save a climate worth living in. You've just been to an important meeting in Geneva. Who organized it and what was it about?
This particular meeting in Geneva really actually started with the Paris Agreement, which is the current latest international treaty guiding all of the action globally on climate change. The request in the Paris Agreement was for the IPCC, the definitive body for assessing what we know overall on climate change, to look specifically at a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. What are the impacts and risks at 1.5 degrees Celsius warming? And what does that mean for how we need to prepare for what's in the pipeline barreling towards us rather rapidly? And how do we integrate our adaptive responses with the full suite of action on the climate challenge?
So who was there?
This meeting in particular was what's called a scoping meeting. It was the very first meeting that happens in developing an IPCC report. Scientists come together with representatives of governments, and they consider what are the most important topics and questions around this issue, in this case, a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, what that means for how we adapt, and what it means in terms of how we ramp up our reactions and actions in the climate challenge right now.
Do we know, Catherine, how different our world would be if we had just 1.5 degrees C of warming versus 2 degrees C?
And maybe I'll even just start with the current world. You could say that the most important reason that people were coming together was this increasing recognition that climate change is not just a hypothetical, something out there far on the horizon, but instead something that's here and now with impacts that are already widespread and consequential on all continents of the world. Increasingly, we recognize that our current world, with its warming of about 1 degree Celsius, poses risks that for some people in some places are already dangerous, and those are risks that go up as we head towards 1.5, 2 degrees Celsius warming. There are a lot of different categories of risk where we can point to differences between our current world, a world of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, a world of 2 degrees Celsius warming. These are often around some of the most temperature-sensitive systems on the planet, coral reefs and fishing communities dependent on them, systems of Arctic sea ice and the indigenous peoples who make those systems part of their livelihoods and cultures. But there are also a lot of impacts that are very complex, that bear large consequences, the linkages between climate change and conflict. What happens when there's extreme events on one side of the planet and it ripples through in terms of impacts for supply chains around the globe? Those are some of the impacts where we know the risks go up from now to 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warming, where we need to be prepared, but it's more challenging to point to precisely what the differences will be, and it really emphasizes the importance of thinking about risk.
I'm curious, do some of the scientists you talk with consider the possibility of abrupt climate change?
I think this question of abrupt climate change is really interesting, and it unfolds actually on a number of different timescales. When we say, in our current moment, what are the abrupt climate changes that matter? Oftentimes, it really comes down to extreme events. I think of extremes as the sharp end of the climate system, whether that's a heat wave, a flood, a drought, coastal storms, and what they mean in terms of both winds and flooding. Those sharp ends of the climate system's hazards, abrupt events happening now with unfolding risks around the world are where we see many of the most severe impacts for people, ecosystems, economies, and where we know climate change is driving up the risks into the future. This phrase abrupt also is very often used for things that are abrupt on geological timescales. And these are changes that may be irreversible and bear very large consequences that will play out over centuries to millennia. So when we say what's abrupt for an ice sheet, it actually may be some of the changes we're locking in terms of how these ice sheets will melt irreversibly over the next centuries to millennia due to our warming at present and the many meters of sea level rise that could entail.
All right, let's step back a minute. What is Working Group 2?
The IPCC is structured with three working groups overall. Working Group 2 is the one where I devoted much of my efforts over the last several years, and it involves many hundreds of scientists from around the world looking in particular at what's at stake in a changing climate for people, economies, communities around the world, and what we can do to prepare for the impacts that are in the pipeline, baked into the system, at least on the climate side. This working group two sits in the entirety of the IPCC, which looks at everything from the physics of a changing climate, what's happening with hazards, sea level rise, feedbacks, all the way through to the full suite of climate change responses, which involve important needs and opportunities around reducing our emissions of heat-trapping gases.
So it's my understanding that the group you are working with for the scoping report on a new report is building on something called the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction. Catherine Mack, please tell us what that is.
There are a variety of very fundamental, important foundations on the international landscape. Disaster risk reduction and the Sendai Framework is one of them. Another critical one has been the sustainable development goals put forward over the last few years, really looking at fundamental priorities for human development around the globe through the next decades. And I'd say that the third piece in this picture really was the Paris Agreement. All of these different dimensions of thinking about our actions right now, what those consequences are in terms of extremes, how we can prepare for them, and how we can really tap the fact that reducing disaster risk, adapting to climate change, is completely intertwined with the human endeavor more broadly, sustainable development, how we can build a better world on many different fronts simultaneously.
Yeah, you've raised something that I think the climate community has yet to grasp, which is the relationship between climate change and poverty. That's very important at the United Nations level, and yet when I look at the work of climate groups in North America and Europe, they're less concerned with it, obviously, because they aren't poor. So how do these two interlock?
I would say in many ways the challenge of climate change is all about poverty versus wealth and how we've achieved that historically and what that means for changing the vision moving forward. I think one of the most basic ways to think about this is that if we look at countries today in the world where people are wealthy, secure in their livelihoods, able to pursue their objectives and desires, those countries have reached that level of wealth through energy systems reliant on fossil fuels. So we have a very strong, nearly linear relationship between our emissions of heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere and the wealth of nations. And the challenge moving forward is to take that relationship and break it and to make sure we can find ways to achieve very high qualities of life, high levels of income per person in countries around the globe without that requiring fossil fuel emissions. We're not that far from a world where clean energy is the good stuff, where we don't need to rely on emissions of heat-trapping gases. And that can come on a variety of different fronts, all being deployed simultaneously. Some of that is how we tap renewable energy, wind and solar. Others might be how we move towards capturing emissions of heat-trapping gases and inject them underground. Other dimensions are being more efficient in our use of electricity and the intensity with which that requires carbon emissions.
You know, getting back to that Sendai Agreement, I noticed that they call for fewer casualties from extreme climate, and that seems difficult when we consider about heat, drought, fire, storm surges, the unknown response of the insect world and diseases like Zika to climate disruption. How do experts and governments think saving lives is possible?
I think you're absolutely right that we have a clear understanding that our continued emissions of heat-trapping gases drive up the risks. And in many cases, the most complex risks are going to be very hard to predict in advance. These are outcomes that we may not have seen, whether that's to do with forest dieback or interactions of people losing their territorial integrity in small island nations. I think the very compelling component is that we see risks at present in the current world that do have a climate change signal that are also about natural variability. And we can use lessons from those to really understand what that means for preparing for risks moving forward. If you think about where is very sophisticated responses to uncertain futures happening in the current world, it's in realms like military or insurance. And there are sophisticated approaches that can be used for grappling with the fact that the future is always uncertain for a whole bunch of different reasons. Climate change adds uncertainty to that picture, but we can make very good guesses and evaluations and considerations of possible futures that embrace that uncertainty and figure out how we can meet our objectives nonetheless.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to the 2016 fall season opener of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's return to the workings of the official world as it grapples with unthinkable climate danger. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Catherine Mack, from the Carnegie Institution at Stanford University. We're talking about how science can advise governments on the dangers of extreme climate change. Catherine, I'm wondering, how does the United Nations work on adaptation fit in with the movement I'll call resilient communities in North America and in Europe?
You can really think about climate change adaptation, reducing vulnerability, increasing resilience, all being the same thing. They have slightly different shades and feels, and some words resonate with more some communities more than others, but they're getting at the same idea of how do we increase our toughness to the impacts that climate change bears? How do we safeguard our communities? How do we prepare for what's in store? I think what you might be pointing to in some ways emphasizes the degree to which this is not just international action. Becoming prepared for the impacts of climate change has dimensions that tie all the way down to the community level, what people are thinking about around the dining room table, in communities and churches together, what's happening at the scale of cities where many of the impacts of a changing climate hit the ground, especially in terms of extreme events, and how that adds up to national scale responses where governments will want to be able to deploy resources intelligently, decide where you deal with impacts in place, where you might want to move assets, how disaster relief should be shaped in a climate that is changing. The international framework in many ways provides an umbrella, a starting point for thinking about needs in different contexts, but all of those layers come together from communities to corporations all the way through to the different levels of governance.
You know, every day from a science alert service, I get notices of at least a dozen new climate papers, and worldwide it's probably hundreds. How can massive streams of new data and scientific publications be assessed at the macro level? And I know that's something you specialize in. I suppose I'm asking, is the ecosphere beyond our ability to comprehend?
In a changing climate, in a world where there are multiple threats to sustainability and a whole suite of opportunities for thinking about shaping possible futures, grappling with the best available scientific foundations to inform our actions is essential. And I think you have exactly outlined the challenge of assessment, integrating our understanding across lines of evidence, recognizing that sometimes we'll have very quantitative projections, but we'll know that there are parameters in that model that are fundamentally unknowable, and we have to pair those quantitative evaluations of risk with more holistic understanding. So that is the challenge of assessment, and we see compelling examples of assessment happening in many different places around the world. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example, is one prominent actor in the climate change assessment space. And it tackles that number of studies coming out very rapidly through a few fundamental dimensions. First, there's the mandate to be comprehensive. The hundreds of scientists that participate in the IPCC process are not just saying, you know, here's what my research says. Scientists participating as experts in the IPCC assessment process have a mandate for considering all of the available understanding towards any question being considered. So for the working group to report, that meant that there were close to 15,000 publications evaluated across the 2,000 pages of text. A major way that is achieved is through very extensive public reviews of the reports, where any expert in the world can sign up to submit comments on the assessment that's been achieved so far. And authors developing these reports then have to consider and respond to each and every one of those comments. It really pushes these reports to be representative as much as possible of the entire scientific endeavor in the current moment, beyond just the hundreds of scientists who participate. I think a final part of the IPCC process that you see in many different climate change assessment contexts is the fact that there's a recognition that it's not just about scientists pushing science out into the world, but that that assessment is much more effective. It addresses questions that matter when there are two-way interactions between experts and decision makers shaping what questions do we need to know about right now to inform actions and decisions, and how can we make sure that decision makers see that full process of assessment and understand where the final results come from.
You know, personally, I think we need to add a third branch to the process. We have scientists, very expert scientists, advising governments, but somehow the corporations are on their own track. I mean, we presume, okay, governments are going to regulate corporations, but it would be great to see corporations more involved right at the first level of science.
I think that is absolutely right and fundamental. But in many ways, a frontier of climate change assessment right now is how do you make it relevant to the business community? How do you make sure that this is not just about national governments, but about every actor that is shaped by a changing climate? And how in so many cases, corporations encompassing the risks of climate change into their practice improves their profits, really is about win-wins. As well as we look at many different places where the technological advancements and innovations that businesses entail in their work will be fundamental to solving the climate challenge and will really unfold the economic opportunities of this century. We've seen some innovations, for example, a risky business approach where there is a stakeholder model that was not just about government stakeholders, but about corporations and businesses and wide suites of decision makers. And I think very exciting opportunities lie ahead in terms of thinking about how to make sure the decision makers at the table are not just government decision makers, but everyone out there looking to make decisions in a changing climate.
Yeah, the risky business people brought in the whole idea of pensions, too, and how they invest and just sort of Wall Street investors. Anyway, the agenda for the upcoming report on extreme climate events calls for a study of impacts on food production. How is that going? What are you hearing?
Yes, so the IPCC has a suite of special reports coming out, and one of them will be focusing on land and food. And this will be quite a holistic look at how we think about sustainable agriculture in a changing climate, how we think about food security, recognizing that that may be about food production in some places and it really may be about access in others, and how we encompass land more broadly in our climate change mitigation responses as we think about enhancing sinks for greenhouse gases entering into the land, how we think about reducing sources, for example, through things like fires.
And these reports talk about adaptation. What kind of adaptation is possible?
We see adaptation relevant across almost every part of the human endeavor. And, you know, part of the Paris Agreement has been, how do we define our adaptation goals? And it's a profoundly deep question in that adaptation affects our use of water, for example. How do we think about making sure there's sufficient access to water resources globally in a changing climate? It jumps through to food. How do we think about both the production dimension as well as distribution in a changing climate, and how climate change adds pressures to a system where there will be increases in food demand moving forward? How do we think about the diversity of responses as you go from cities through to rural areas and countrysides? How do we think about making sure our economies are resilient, both for the big developed countries of the world and for emerging economies where there are extra pressures from a changing climate? So I love adaptation because it touches really on every part of the human endeavor, from health to technology, from security to what we do within local communities. And that series of interactions, from defining goals at a very broad scale through to making sure each action we take can be evaluated and measured and monitored through time, is a very compelling domain in adaptation science where assessment will add value, but we're also going to be seeing a lot of action that we will need to learn from over the next few years.
Catherine, you were younger than some scientists I interview. You will probably live to see climate change hit every aspect of our lives and all living things. Personally, I think we're headed some very difficult decades, even if we try hard to change. Given what science knows, you personally, aside from what you might tell governments, what do you see in the future?
I think a very compelling part of my experience working on climate change in the assessment context is that I really have experienced the fact that this is a multi-generational issue. Many of the leading scientists right now at the peaks of their career have been watching the climate challenge unfold to date. From the 80s and the 90s, where people were really trying to figure out, is this an issue that's unfolding right now? How big should the priority be in terms of how governments tackle it? And now we see those scientists increasingly having shifted through the IPCC framework to where I entered, a world where we understand that climate change is unambiguously happening. Warming is unequivocal. It's clearly due to humans. And we see some very stark choices moving forward. In terms of how things unfold into the future, it is something that will span the course of my life and the course of my children's life and grandchildren, and I think any scientist working on the issue right now would have that same perspective. I think we see the importance of our current moment, the fact that we need to be developing the technologies of this century, not just relying on those from the last century or the century before that, and that that's as much about economic opportunity as it is about challenges of innovation and potential for leadership. At the same time that we figure out the mitigation frontier, how we turn the tide on our rising emissions and drive them to zero, ideally within this century, we're also going to need to prepare for impacts baked into the climate system, what's in the pipeline already, and how that affects the ability of people around the world to meet their objectives. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a very compelling issue that will span decades into the future and touch on almost every part of what people are doing in countries throughout the world. And it's why it's an issue I love, and I think it's endlessly fascinating and important.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I've really enjoyed speaking with you today, and I think where we started, this 1.5 degrees Celsius report, in many ways, I think we'll put a current focus on what the impacts of climate change are right now, what that means for our actions in the next few years. And I think that will be an important unfolding as the years roll ahead and this Paris Agreement, which is really just a starting point for global action on climate change, unfolds and we see ambitious action increasing year after year.
From Stanford University in California, we've been talking with Catherine Mack. She is a senior research associate at Carnegie Sciences Department of Global Ecology. Catherine is also a driving force organizing science for the study of extreme climate events for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You can find links to many of the things we've been talking about, including some of those reports, in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Catherine, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It was great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Can your baby hear and learn in the womb? Yes, that is true of many species. Can the unborn learn about climate change? Well, apparently so, as shown by a new scientific study in Australia. We'll go to the lead author, Mylène Mariette. She's the Alfred Deakin Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Center for Integrative Ecology at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. Mylène, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what led you to this study and what kind of bird are we talking about?
So the bird we are talking about is actually a desert bird. So they live in the Australian arid zone, so they're adapted to being in hot places. And it's a small common bird, but it's also quite well known everywhere because it's also a cage bird, so people have them as pets. So that's a zebra finch. So I was studying it for my PhD and then for another project, and I was looking at the communication between the parents. So because both parents incubate the eggs and look after the chicks. And whenever they meet at the nest, they talk to each other. So I was recording those communication between the parents. And then that's when I noticed that sometimes when a parent is by itself in the nest with the egg, and his partner is away from the nest, sometimes that parent would make a completely different sort of call. And so I wonder whether they were talking to the eggs, and if so, what they could be telling them. So that's how it started.
So the desert finch, how do you know the mother birds are talking to their eggs about temperature?
So to do that, we did an experiment at the aviary, actually. So and in Melbourne, the weather changed a lot from one day to the next in summer. So it can be 43 degrees one day and 23 the next day. So that's not the most convenient, but yeah, really, Melbourne weather is famous for that, basically. So we did a lot of recordings every day in the nest of the parents when they were incubating. And then doing the analysis, it became really clear that the parents only produce that call when it's hot. So that's how we found out.
How do we know that embryos in the shell can hear the mother or father?
So we know there are different types of birds. So there are some birds that are quite developed when they hatch. So that's chicken and ducks. And so there the babies can leave the nest as soon as they hatch. And in those birds, there had been a lot of studies done. And we know that they hear and they even produce call before hatching. In birds that are less developed when they hatch, and so those ones stay in the nest for several weeks after they've hatched, and when they hatch, they are naked and blind. Those ones, we didn't really know they could hear before hatching, but our results show that they can. So that's one of the nice things about our study.
And Milene, what makes you think the baby in the shell learned anything about a changing climate?
So we don't really know whether they learned anything per se, but by hearing that call that normally is associated with heat, then they changed the way they adjusted their growth to the temperature that they experienced after hatching. So it's not so much that they learned about it, but it's just that hearing that call, they knew that it was going to be hot, and so they knew they had to adjust their growth. So that's what we found.
Yes, you found the embryos hearing the signal of hotter weather actually weighed less when born. Usually that's thought to be a disadvantage, is it?
Yeah, so we were a bit surprised, actually. And yeah, normally it's better when babies are a bit heavier when they leave the nest because they have more chance of escaping predators or just surviving without less food. So, yeah, normally it's better to be heavy. But in that case, we found that it was actually better to be light if it had been hot. And the way we did this, so to find out whether it was a good thing, we kept the birds and then gave them a chance to breed when they were adults. And we found that the ones that were lighter in hot nests produced more babies as adults. So, but that's, we think, is specifically being light in hot condition. It's not just being light.
Well, that's something that I've noted from other biologists, especially when they study deep time, that species that were smaller can do better in a hotter world. And there's been some indication that maybe things will just get smaller in response to climate change.
Yeah, so it's definitely a general pattern that we've been seeing either through time, which we think is to do with climate change, or with latitude. So animals tend to be smaller in hotter climates. But even if we see that pattern across animals, and that's bird, mammals, reptile, everything, we don't really know whether it's a good or a bad thing. So in our species, we found that it could be a good thing. But in other species, it is actually bad. So, and there was recently a paper on red knots. So they are shorebirds, and in that species, they've shown a clear decline in the baby's size with time. But babies being smaller also have a smaller bill, and it means that they are less able to reach the food in the mud when they grow up. So then they have a much lower survival in their wintering ground. So. We need to do a lot more study to know whether being smaller is actually a good thing in hotter places. It's a pattern we see a lot, but at the moment we don't know whether it's good or bad. So for Harvard specifically, we think that maybe reducing growth in hot conditions allows them to avoid the cost of growing in the heat, because it's just a costly process basically. So growing is normally quite hard on the body, obviously, because it makes the cell work really hard. And doing so in the heat is harder, because there is a risk of overheating basically. So far we don't really know what the mechanism is for smaller body being an advantage. We have several possibilities, but that's still something we need to work on.
And I think part of the appeal of this new science, Milen, is that we all share a worry about our babies in the womb. I've talked to women who wonder if extra heat or worries about global warming even will affect their unborn children. From your work, at least we can say in one species, these subliminal messages may not be all harmful. They may have a benefit. You found some benefit.
Yeah, no, and I think in general, because the communication before birth exists, it's likely to be beneficial. So, and what we found that the parents can actually provide information about the environment to their babies in before birth. Yeah, that is a good thing, and it is quite encouraging, because it means that birds have more flexible strategy than we realized, because we didn't know they could do that. We know they have other ways of influencing the development of their babies, so they can change the size of the egg or the content in hormones or those sort of things. But now we know that they can even call to them, and then that changes their development. So that's quite encouraging.
Does your study apply to all birds?
No. So, I mean, we'll need to do more study to find out. So I think it means that it's quite likely that other bird species also talk to their eggs, but the connection with heat may be more specific to species who breed in hot environments. And also, because the zebra finch is a desert species, they can breed any time of the year. Because they breed usually after rain, so they can be breeding in winter or in summer. So in those specific conditions, it makes sense to have a strategy to tell the embryos whether or not it's going to be hot. In species that breed like in spring or at a very specific time of the year all the time, then maybe they wouldn't have evolved a strategy to warn their babies about the heat. But maybe they're, telling them about something else in the environment.
What will you study next?
So next we really want to understand what happened. So we want to understand the physiological mechanism behind the effects that we found on the growth. So, and that would be really quite exciting to look at how sound before birth can affect the physiology of the embryos and the babies. So that's the next step.
From Deakin's University in Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with Milen Mariette. With Catherine Buchanan, Milen is the lead author of the paper Prenatal Acoustic Communication Programs Offspring for High Post-Hatching Temperatures in a Songbird, and that was published August 19th, 2016 in the journal Science. You can find links to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Milen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
That's all the time we have for this week. In our next program, I'll be covering the extreme events around the globe and the various canaries that have already passed out down in that coal mine. I'll be talking with a science correspondent. You can tune in to the worries you may have missed this summer as the media snoozed on. I'm Alex Smith. Get more of my show blog at ecoshock.info. It's published every Wednesday. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We're joined now, happily and luckily, by Zafar Bengash. Are you there, sir?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am. I don't know why we keep on having this difficulty with respect to connecting. I was checking my phones and I sort of, you know, and I wasn't able to figure out what's happening because there were no messages. And then all of a sudden, I get this message that, that you know, somebody is trying to reach me. So.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so well, we're connected.
We're dogged. Zafar, thank you very much for joining us because, you know, we have these burning issues. Today's New York Times, let's start with the one that is close to your heart, I know, because it's a story of Kashmir. We want to make sure we talk about that as well as the developments with Turkey, Syria. But Kashmir is on, I guess it's made the front page of the New York Times today, so it's being talked about for this day, but you've pointed out over the years that Kashmir, there's been some sort of agreement amongst the powers not to talk about Kashmir.
Now, yes, unfortunately.
Why?
I mean, you know, this has gone on for more than almost 70 years now, and that's because today the world powers don't want to talk about it because India, basically, they see India as a bulwark against China. They see it as a sort of emerging market and so on. So they are more concerned about emerging markets rather than emerging human rights. Basically, that's what it is. And the price, of course, is paid by the poor Kashmiri people. In the latest sort of, you know, protest that erupted immediately after the extrajudicial killing of one of the freedom fighters, a young man, 22-year-old, his name was Burhan Wani. He was basically surrounded by Indian forces, and then together with two of his colleagues, he was murdered on July the 8th. And the very next morning, there were more than 200,000 people that poured out into the streets for his funeral service. Of course, the Indian army immediately clamped down a curfew, but people were not going to care for that curfew. So another 7-8 people were shot dead during the funeral procession. About 20-25 people were wounded. And since that time, which is July the 9th to the present day, there has been round-the-clock curfew in Kashmir. In most major cities in Kashmir, about 80 to 90 people have been killed. Last week, Reuters and Agence France-Presse reported that at least 8,000 people have been wounded. And in fact, the New York Times report that you referred to, that also mentioned these injuries to people's, particularly the youth, to their eyesight or their eyes, because Indian forces are using pellet guns, which basically spray hundreds of steel pellets that are tipped with, coated with rubber, and they consider them, quote-unquote, non-lethal weapons. Mm-hmm. There is nothing non-lethal about them. They have blinded about 150, 200 people.
Actually, New York Times says 570.
Yeah, probably.
And it's called the epidemic of dead eyes.
Yes,
they
exactly
know what they're doing with this weapon.
Absolutely, because, you know, they are shooting these pellet guns or bullets at young people. And these young people, unfortunately, the way the situation has evolved, they don't have any leaders. There is no organization. This is just absolute frustration on the part of these youth because they are fed up with the Indian occupation army. And that totals something like 700,000 troops in Kashmir. It is the most heavily militarized region in the world. In fact, in the capital city, Srinagar, every neighborhood or every street, like, you know, at the end of a street, the people live in streets. You see, they're sort of from the main road, there will be a street that goes in, so there are houses on both sides. These are narrow alleys. And at the entrance to each of these narrow alleys, there are graveyards because so many people have been killed. So there are, like, you know, there are no communal graveyards anymore. Basically, people have their own graveyards because of the number of deaths. Secondly, there have been literally thousands of people that were essentially kidnapped by the Indian occupation forces. They simply disappeared. And mass graves have been discovered in different parts of Kashmir. These have been reported on by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Even human rights organizations in India have reported on them. The BBC reported on them. In fact, they had a documentary on them many years ago. India simply refuses to carry out any investigations into that. Yep. And one other point that I want to mention, and that is that Indian troops have been involved in not only killings and torture and kidnappings, but their more, I believe their most egregious crime is the rape of Kashmiri women. Mm-hmm. From 1989, when the last uprising had begun, up to the present time, more than 11,000 Kashmiri women have been raped by Indian troops. And, you know, the doctors in Srinagar, they had a seminar in 2015, in which they revealed some startling details. They said that in 2014, there were at least 3,500 women that had been raped by Indian troops. And they said that, number one, this figure is grossly underreported because many women, because of shame and stigma, do not report these things. But he said the greater tragedy is that out of the 3,500 reported cases, there was only one person out of 3,500 cases who was ever charged with this crime. Hmm. In 2015, there were 3,935 reported or registered cases of rape. Regrettably, not even one person has been charged with that. So you see that the Indian Army is doing a lot of terrible things, and unfortunately, you know, governments around the world have maintained a deathly silence. In fact, our own government, Canada, has said nothing about it. Even though when the issue originally came to the Security Council back in 1948, at that time, Canada was a rotating member of the Security Council, and Canada voted in that Security Council to have a referendum in Kashmir. That's the bottom line of the demand of the Kashmiri people.
And there's never been one.
It has never been one. India has consistently refused. It says there is no need for a referendum. We have had elections there, and that's it. And it's part of India, and you can do whatever you like.
Yeah.
And they are doing it at the point of the gun, at the point of the bayonet, killing people. So, you know, from 1989 to the present time, about 100,000 people have been killed.
Mm.
So that gives you some indication.
With 600,000 soldiers there, it's amazing. Heavy occupation of that region. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Zafar, there is one department, one way in which the Indians reveal that they do regard Kashmir as an exceptional people or nation. That is that this is the only people they use these pellet canisters against. They do not use them against the Indian people.
Nobody.
And there's no shortage of political activity and riots and demonstrations in India itself, but they don't use this.
Exactly. This is the only place, in fact, in the world where pellet guns are used. And also, in the Indian constitution, there is Article 370 that confers a special status on Kashmir. And this dates back to the Indian occupation of Kashmir, military occupation, back in October of 1947, when the ruler had fled the capital city, Srinagar, because the people at that time wanted to become part of Pakistan. I mean, this was the agreement in terms of the partition of British colonial India into Pakistan and India. But the ruler happened to be Hindu, and he sort of had inclinations towards India. Mm. And so since that time, India has maintained its military grip. And even though its rulers promised to hold a referendum at that time, repeated from 1947 until about 1952. After that, they started to backtrack and start making excuses, and we have this situation today, unfortunately.
Yeah. Again, it's Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Now, Zafar, Turkey is behaving somewhat erratically What do you think is going on here with the incursion into Syrian territory? And what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, basically, Turkey's primary goal is not to allow the Kurds of Syria, the northern part of Syria, to occupy any territory and to link up with the Kurds in Turkey. I'll have to say, I'm afraid the Kurds are not playing, not behaving very well either.
Oh, by the way, I have to really make sure I ask you this. There is always confusion about who, is there one leadership, multiple leadership, which Kurdish group is not, in your view, trustworthy exactly?
Well, in Turkey itself, there is a group called the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party. They are, they've been declared a terrorist organization. They've been involved in a lot of terrorist activities. Mm-hmm. In Syria, they call themselves, they don't even call themselves Kurds. Actually, they carry this name, Syrian Democratic Forces. Mm-hmm. But, their aim, of course, is to carve out northern Syria and link up with the Kurds in southeastern Turkey so that they would form their own independent state of Kurdistan. And the Americans are backing the Kurds in Syria. So right now you have this very strange situation whereby Turkey, that is an ally of the United States, NATO member and so on, but it's fighting against the Kurds that are being backed by the U.S. So you have this strange situation emerging over there. And Turkey is not doing anything to fight the terrorists, the ISIS terrorists, that have unfortunately caused a lot of chaos and mayhem in Turkey as well, with bombings and suicide bombings and others. Like, on August the 15th, there was a suicide bomber at a wedding in Gaziantep, which is actually a Kurdish area, but they killed about 50, 60 people. There was a wedding taking place. But Turkey has not said much about that, although it has issued warnings. But its operations inside Syria with 50 tanks and special forces, etc., is primarily aimed against the Kurds.
Mm-hmm. Now, quickly, the American media is confused and they're trying to figure it out. They say our friends are fighting our friends.
Exactly.
So they
keep funny company.
Somebody is going to be betrayed. I don't know. Do you have an idea who it might be?
Well, I think the way it is going, it seems to me that Turkey obviously is absolutely determined that they are not going to allow the Kurds to have their own autonomous or independent state or region in that part of the world. Because for Turkey, that is the Turks, at least from their point of view, they consider it absolutely crucial. Otherwise, Turkey is going to be split up. Syria is going to be split up. Iraq, for all practical purposes, has already been split up into three, autonomous regions. And the Kurdistan, which is called the Iraqi Kurdistan, basically operates as a de facto independent state. And that's something that Turkey simply will not allow.
Well, Zafar, we managed to cover the key issues. And my apologies to you because you're a brilliant analyst and we really need your insight. Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Go there for greater detail. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIET 9.5 FM. We are on SoundCloud. And as I say, I wish I knew what I said when I said that, but we are on SoundCloud, so look us up. And of course, you can go to facebook.com/TheTaylor, The Taylor Report, not a The Taylor Report. And Charlotte, Phil, thank you very much, and see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Laura Carlson of the Center for International Policy, who discusses the political circumstances surrounding Donald Trump's visit to Mexico and why the invitation was extended to a figure who has so often insulted the Mexican people. Cody Hall, a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Nation, who talks about the protests resisting construction of the South Dakota Access Pipeline across the Missouri River and on indigenous lands. And James S. Henry of the Tax Justice Network, who examines the decision by the European Union demanding that Apple pay $14.5 billion in back taxes to Ireland and the wider issue of international corporate tax avoidance. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Labor advocates are hoping to use international aid donated after the April 2015 earthquake that devastated Nepal to break the link between child labor and the brick-making industry in the Asian country. More than a year after the earthquake, Nepal's capital Kathmandu is still buried in rubble, but local kilns are working to fill the enormous demand for new bricks being used in reconstruction projects. An estimated 60,000 children now work in the brick kilns instead of going to school. Despite the influx of international aid flowing into the country, the Nepalese brickmaking industry is resistant to ending child labor. Labor rights advocates hope they can use the $4.1 billion in reconstruction funds from donor nations as leverage to keep children in school and reduce the number of young people working in manual labor jobs. Better Brick Nepal, a pilot program established in 2013, provides technical support to 23 kilns to help them improve their production efficiency and brick quality. In return, the kilns must ban child labor, bonded, and forced labor. But the project also stipulates that contractors who receive part of the $4.1 billion in international aid must buy their bricks from kilns that don't employ child laborers. The American appetite for locally grown organic food is surging. More health-conscious consumers are demanding to know where their food comes from, amid growing concern about genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, commonly used in processed foods. However, a major threat to American health comes from the billion pounds of pesticides used every year in conventional agriculture. Intense use of pesticides puts rural communities, especially children, at risk, reports the American Prospect. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, report 7-year-olds test lower on cognitive tests if their mothers were pregnant when heavy applications of organophosphates or other pesticides were used on crops. Health researchers have found that people living in agricultural communities face increased risk of asthma, neurodegenerative diseases, and cancer due to repeated exposure to certain pesticides. Much of this research was conducted in California's Farm Belt through the Center for the Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas, or Chamacos. Other researchers have concluded that even low levels of exposure to pesticides can lower a child's IQ and damage their future prospects. Bruce Lamphere of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia links exposure to pesticides to rising levels of learning and behavioral problems in children, which jumped 17% over the last 15 years. 3 years ago, the city of Philadelphia closed 24 public schools. Among those shuttered was Germantown High, a majority African-American school known for its college prep honors courses, arts, and sports. The high school also had inspired generations of black students to become teachers and school administrators. In the 1970s, Philadelphia's racially isolated schools weren't closed. Instead, they received an infusion of funds from local, state, and federal governments to compensate for years of segregation and unequal funding. In the process, the district hired many new black and Latino teachers with deep roots in the community. The teaching profession was seen by many black women as a pathway to the middle class. A large number of black teachers also became strong advocates for equitable school funding. However, after 20 years of school reforms, Mother Jones magazine reports that prospects for black teachers have substantially diminished. In Philadelphia, the number of African-American teachers has fallen by 19% since 2001. But the layoffs of black teachers in other major American cities, such as Chicago and New Orleans, has been far worse, where their number has declined by over 40%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Millions of Mexicans were surprised and angry when their president, Enrique Peña Nieto, met with GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump. The meeting, which took place on August 31st, after Peña Nieto extended an invitation to both Trump and Hillary Clinton, came amid attempts by Trump's campaign to clarify his often contradictory positions on illegal immigration. The immigration issue has been a centerpiece of the billionaire real estate mogul's campaign, which he launched by calling for the mass deportation of 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. and condemning Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers. Trump also has promised to build a border wall that he said he'd force the Mexican government to pay for. In a joint Mexico City news conference following a private meeting between the two men, Peña Nieto did little to challenge Trump's insults against his nation, and Trump himself struck a moderate tone. However, later that day, in a speech delivered in Phoenix, Trump aggressively repeated his hard-line position on immigration, vowing again to carry out mass deportations. When asked by reporters, Trump denied that he and the Mexican president had discussed his pledge to have Mexico pay for the construction of his proposed border wall. But Peña Nieto later tweeted that during their meeting, he had made it clear to Trump that Mexico will never pay for the wall. Your reporter spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Center for International Policy's Americas program based in Mexico City. Here, Carlson discusses the political circumstances surrounding Trump's visit to Mexico and why the invitation was extended to a politician who has so often insulted the Mexican people.
The official explanation was that Peña Nieto wanted to engage in dialogue and perhaps even be able to talk face-to-face with Trump about some of the most offensive proposals that he's put out regarding Mexico, in particular the wall that would cover the entire border and the immediate deportation of some 11 million undocumented workers, the vast majority of whom are Mexicans. However, things did not work out that way. What happened instead was that Trump came in and stood up next to Peña Nieto, was treated as a statesman, despite the fact that he's a losing, so far, candidate, and was able to take control of the entire situation. He reiterated his support for a wall and even said that Peña Nieto agreed that he had a right to build a wall if he wanted to, which is, in fact, an act of aggression against a neighbor and a commercial partner as important as Mexico when one supposes that the two countries are allies. And he then went on to say how much he appreciated the opportunity and that he was willing to work together with Peña Nieto to resolve these problems. So obviously he was looking presidential. And Peña Nieto not only let him, but ended up justifying him, saying that he'd been misinterpreted, that he had absolute respect for Donald Trump, and that he was sure that Donald Trump at heart had the genuine interests of both the Mexican and the U.S. people. What happened immediately after was really kind of the proof of the whole way that this was set up. It turned out to be a tremendous boon to Donald Trump. He was able to go back to Arizona and say that he had spoken to the president of Mexico about these proposals, that he loved Mexicans, that he loved the president of Mexico, but that he was going to build a wall and that he was going to deport 11 million people. And what was probably, certainly to me, the most offensive part of that speech was that it began and ended with a litany of violent crimes committed by undocumented workers. Now, what he did do in the discourse was exchange the word Mexican for illegal alien, making it a little more veiled, the reference to, you know, what have been very openly racist references in the past. But the implication that violent crime in the United States is the result of Mexicans, and particularly Mexicans without papers, is not only offensive, but it's completely absurd. While you could no doubt cherry pick a group of people, as he did, who have lost children or loved ones to violent crime and create a subgroup of those criminals, the idea of extending that to vilify, you know, an entire population was even beyond what he's done before.
Being an observer in Mexico, what's the discussion surrounding people's questions and possible answers as to why President Peña Nieto invited an American presidential candidate who has based his entire campaign on insulting and attacking the Mexican people as rapists and drug dealers?
Well, the rumor is that the Secretary of the Treasury, Luis Videgaray, recommended to President Peña Nieto that he speak with Trump, that he invite Trump to Mexico with the idea that if he were to become president, and as you know, even though he's trailing, no serious analysts are completely discarding the possibility yet. If he were to become president, they wanted to avoid any dislocation in the financial markets. Mexico economically and in the financial markets has been very precarious lately. And this is the rumor anyway. Nobody's come out straight for and said that. There were others who said that would be a colossal mistake. But for one reason or another, Peña Nieto decided that he would look statesmanlike if he engaged in a direct dialogue with Donald Trump. This was more than a political calculation. This was a diplomatic disaster. There's no question now. I mean, the response from the Mexican people especially has been extremely critical. They can't understand why their president would do something like this. And there's been all kinds of jokes and criticisms that have been going through the social networks since this visit.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Center for International Policy's Americas program, based in Mexico City. Find more analysis of Trump's visit to Mexico and the presidential campaign debate over immigration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In what is the largest gathering of indigenous tribes in the U.S. in many decades, members of more than 100 Native nations have come together on the land of the Sterling Rock Sioux in North Dakota under the battle cry of "Water is Life." Members of the tribes and their non-Native allies have come together to protect the waters of the Missouri River from being crossed by a fracked oil pipeline linking the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to a giant storage facility in Patoka, Illinois, near regional refineries. Those assembled are committed to an all-out nonviolent resistance against Transfer Partners' attempt to build the Dakota Access Pipeline across their land. The 1,100-mile pipeline would carry 500,000 barrels of highly explosive oil per day across four states to Illinois. On September 3rd, the company's security guards used dogs and chemical mace to keep protesters at a distance while the company began bulldozing a new piece of land to build the pipeline. The bulldozed area is a burial ground considered a sacred site by the tribe. Representatives of the tribe went to federal court on September 6th, seeking an emergency temporary injunction to immediately stop construction, allowing time for a lawsuit to be considered that seeks to permanently halt the pipeline project. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Cody Hall, a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Nation in South Dakota, who's acting as a spokesperson for the Red Warrior Camp, which is directing the nonviolent pipeline resistance. Here he explains what activists are doing to oppose the pipeline and how those in solidarity can support their effort.
This proposed pipeline is going to go right over that 1851 treaty land, and that's what we're talking about as far as it being native domain land. And then, of course, the powers that be went shortened the 1851 treaty down to the 1868 treaty, and then said it was, you know, here's what the native people have, what is presently now, you know, Standing Rock. But we're going by the 1851 treaty land.
What can you tell us about the legal effort in Washington, D.C. In late August to get an injunction against the company from proceeding with the work?
The judge didn't make a ruling on a yes or no, but he did mention that construction can still happen. They can still proceed with construction. When we saw it, the underlinings of that in the fine print, it was like, okay, there has to be something that should be done about the progression of this pipeline. Because even though at the original, you know, they call it the protest site, the energy and oil companies, they're still proceeding to the east. They're building up on the east side of the river, and then they're building on the west side of the river where the protest site is. And we need to stop that, and not just here in part of the Standing Rock Res. I'm saying the existence of the whole pipeline itself, all the way down through South Dakota, through Iowa, and then Illinois. So that's why I phrase that term, that we will make sure that this pipeline dies. We're just on the front lines right now.
But the company is continuing to build the pipeline.
They want to have a good majority of this construction done, so by the time they go to the judge, here's the case, the judge will look at it and say, well, how far have you progressed? Where are you at? And if they can say, well, you know, we are 95% near completion for North Dakota, you know, the judge will say, well, there's not much I can do about it. If you guys are that close, I'll let you complete it. You just pay your fines, and then, you know, they'll move forward. So we're trying to prevent all of that from happening because it's not right. I mean, you know, we're not going to wait for the judge to make a call. If we can stop that momentum, then we have to. We need to take that action. So that way when the judge does look at it and says, well, how far are you guys? And if they say we're not halfway yet, I think that, you know, would be fair for us and in our fight to say that we're stopping momentum and that hopefully the judge, he'll rule in our favor. So, you know, that's why the sacrifice of those that are giving up their freedom to do this.
Cody Hall, the indigenous people leading this fight have put out a call for solidarity actions around the country and I guess around the world, focusing on the companies that own the pipeline as well as the consortium of banks that are funding it. Can you say more about that?
We're hoping that people and groups, organizations, whatever it is, to go and make a stand at work sites, to make a stand at headquarters, the Enbridge headquarters, raise awareness of what's going on. You know, because I get it, some people needed an action. They needed somebody to kind of be the fall guy to take all the heat. And that ended up being the indigenous people, the native people right here that all gathered up here at the camp. This is a movement. This is a people's movement. This isn't, one tribe or many tribal people coming, you know, saying that it's their movement. It's everybody's movement. It's a humanitarian issue right now because this water will be poisoned, and it will affect the Standing Rock people first, and then it goes down the river, and it will affect my people on Cheyenne River next, and it just keeps going down the line, you know. It'll affect all of South Dakota. It'll affect all of Nebraska. You know, we have to raise awareness on this, that there's other alternative means for fossil fuels. There's no alternative for water. There's no plan B if the water is gone.
Hundreds of indigenous and non-indigenous people have been flocking to your camps on the banks of the Missouri River. Are more people welcome?
If you can make it, physically come support, and we welcome you with open arms and open hearts. But if you cannot make it in a physical presence here in North Dakota, please keep us in your prayers and just hear our fight. Find us on Red Warrior Camp on Facebook, Instagram. You know, we meet all these social media accounts and join and share the truth that we're speaking. I thank you guys so much for your support. And, we love you, and that means a lot to the people here that, you know, that are on the front lines.
That was Cody Hall, a spokesperson for the Red Warrior Camp on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. For more information on organized resistance to the North Dakota Pipeline Project, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The European Union has ordered the nation of Ireland to collect $14.5 billion in taxes from the U.S.-based computer and technology company Apple. The directive issued by the EU's executive branch on August 30th stated that Dublin had granted unfair and illegal tax breaks to the tech giant. Margrethe Vestager, the EU's commissioner in charge of competition policy, explained that under EU rules, member states cannot give tax benefits to selected companies. Apple, which has two companies incorporated in Ireland, had negotiated a sweetheart deal with the country, allowing the corporation to pay substantially less in taxes than other businesses. While Ireland's corporate tax rate is 12.5%, Apple paid Ireland an effective tax rate of only 1% on European profits in 2003, and by 2014, that rate had dropped to only 0.005%. Both Ireland and Apple say they will appeal the tax. The U.S. Treasury Department complained that the tax ruling had jeopardized the important spirit of economic partnership between the U.S. and the EU. Other U.S.-based companies, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Amazon, have been ordered to pay back taxes on their European profits. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Here, Henry discusses how the EU demand that Apple pay billions of dollars in back taxes to Ireland relates to the wider issue of corporate tax avoidance around the world.
Well, the European Union is a kind of a consortium of 28 countries. They have rules of order, however, for their member states. They don't actually impose taxes directly. They leave it up to the individual governments. 28 of them are members. Ireland is one of those. They do have rules when it comes to granting tax subsidies. And in this case, what Ireland did on its own was hand out a kind of a very bespoke, we call it, arrangement just for this one company, Apple. Based on a kind of what they call a letter ruling. And they essentially, Ireland starts out with a corporate income tax rate that's already very low. It's 12.5%, which is about one-third of the U.S. rate, one-half of that in the rest of Europe. But Apple wasn't happy with that. Apple being a giant technology company with a lot of sales worldwide, was able to negotiate with the Irish authorities a kind of private ruling that gave them, on average, less than 1% over the last 10 years. And that's the basis for this EU ruling. Basically, the Competition Commission and the EU decided that this was unfair competition, a form of state aid that was granted to one company that would not be available to any other, and therefore, you know, discriminating against not only European companies, but also businesses around the planet. This is just one of a number of cases that the EU is considering in this area. There's about 30 that are on the docket, including giants like Amazon and IKEA. So Apple is not really being singled out here, but I think some of the political reaction that we saw was simply, you know, the United States has the best politicians money can buy, and a lot of them get donations from giant multinationals like like Apple. So they were just treating this as a perfidy that the EU had suddenly claimed all this revenue. In fact, the EU is actually doing the U.S. a big favor.
James, tell us a little bit about how this arrangement in Ireland fits in with the larger picture of tax avoidance by Apple and many other U.S.-based corporations.
Well, the good basis for comparison is with the U.S. corporate income tax system that the United States had, say, back in the 1950s. In that period, let's say, a big company like Sears Roebuck would have sales in all the 50 states, and many of these companies would set up a sales corporation in Delaware. Delaware didn't have a corporate income tax, and the U.S. domestic company would just transfer all of its U.S. income from all over the states to Delaware. And so over time, that system, you know, became outrageous, and all the states complained, and they said, you know, let's work something out where the corporate taxes you pay in New York or California is based on the sales or the employment or the research that you're doing there. On the international tax level, we don't have such a system. So we're still back in the 50s with companies able to basically set up entities anywhere, Ireland, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Cayman Islands, transfer income or activities to them or assets and pay themselves royalties tax-free, you know, not pay any taxes on the income that's generated there, and essentially have these artificial entities that are not based on any real, you know, where the taxation is not based on actual activities.
Well, one topic I know you yourself, as well as your colleagues at the Tax Justice Network, have been thinking a lot about, and that's how nations can work together across borders to close tax loopholes and other complex corporate structures used by major corporations to avoid taxes.
Country-by-country reporting that would require multinationals to disclose how much income they're booking in havens would reveal a lot of these games that they are playing. A second step, which is a kind of formulary apportionment where you have, on a global basis, a similar system to what we have domestically here. Now, that would take a longer time to work out, but there are some simple rules that you could quickly establish, I think, that would get rid of the most egregious forms of transferring, let's say, digital assets to places that don't have any income tax base, like Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. It's ridiculous for Apple to be able to park all of its intellectual property in places that never had, you know, even a computer engineer on their sites. So, you know, that's another kind of game. So there are many, many improvements that we can make in the international system. But at some point, I think all of this depends on countries getting together and deciding we're going to have a kind of fair international tax system that's based on real activities in different places. And then the role of tax havens will go away.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Find more analysis and commentary on the EU investigation into corporate tax avoidance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
The Clinton coup. One can hardly recall the Clinton years without becoming awash in a wave of exhaustion. For despite the rosy cast granted by the passage of time, it was, in fact, a time of immense loss, of constant worry, and social transformation, the effects of which are only dimly being perceived today. We must look at the era critically to see what was actually there, not to toss bouquets and incense over what was not, for in doing so, we can learn a bitter, unmistakable truth. Not all social transformation is a change for the better. And when it came to the Clinton era, the political ascendancy of William Jefferson Clinton, Esquire, there was, to be sure, change, but hardly change for the better. And this was not by mistake. It was by design. President Clinton ushered in the biggest change in habeas corpus since the Lincoln era, when, in the throes of civil war, the president suspended habeas corpus for those who aided and abetted the Southern Confederacy. Lincoln was rebuffed by the court, which held in the Milligan case that when the courts are open, the executive could not dispense with a writ. As we shall see, Clinton was far more subversive. In the wake of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma, Clinton pushed through what came to be called AEDPA, for the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. It was hailed as a tool against terrorism and flew into law as the embers of Oklahoma were still warm. As with any law, it didn't end with terrorism, but became a tool used in everyday non-terrorism-related cases, and especially in death penalty cases. It did what no habeas corpus law had ever done in the nearly 700 years since its British origins. It exalted the findings of an inferior court, by that I mean a lower court, over that of an appellate, or higher, in the American sense, federal court. The higher tribunal, composed of life-tenured judges, nominated by the president and approved by a U.S. Senate majority, and made by the Constitution, were to defer to the reasoning of local, state, and elected judges, who often serve terms like any other politician. By this act, which on its face violates the letter and spirit of the Constitution, Clinton exalted the political over the judicial, to the detriment and ultimate destruction of the historical and practical essence of the writ of habeas corpus, what legal scholars have called, for over a century, the Great Writ. Today, habeas corpus is an obstacle course, one beset with trapdoors and swinging axes, the result of which has fed the dreaded prison-industrial complex by making it harder than ever to prove and prevail when a constitutional violation is made. We can't assume that Mr. Clinton didn't know what was going on, for Clinton was a law professor. He crafted a tool of mass repression that flipped habeas corpus on its head. This was politics, mass as law, to grant the state the power to close the door of the Great Writ and allow more convictions and longer prison terms and expand state power. Have you ever heard any politician say they would repeal AEDPA? Don't hold your breath. Clinton, the author of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which was later declared unconstitutional, was also the author and signatory to AEDPA, which is just as unconstitutional. In the Constitution, Article 6 is written, "The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land." Clinton elevated elected state judges, and by so doing, violated the oath he took as a lawyer and as president of the United States. He left immense suffering as his legacy and gave rise to the Prison House of Nations. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
friends, my brothers, my sisters, I thank you for joining us today. We're here about a medical injustice. Recently, the court, in our case against the DOC and medical treatment, found that the DOC and the company that they contract to provide medical services were not doing what is needed, that is, treating patients. And, in the words of the judge, they used deliberate indifference to people's medical needs. And they did so, he said, based upon fiscal, not medical concerns. We took one step. We are moving forward. But this is not just about myself. There are over 6,000, according to the DOC's numbers, men and women who are infected with hepatitis C and are not being treated. Under the DOC's so-called protocol, which was revealed in our hearing here in Scranton, the DOC essentially let people almost die. They had to be bleeding from their esophagus to be considered for treatment. That was deliberate indifference to medical needs. It created needless suffering, and it is unconstitutional. So we're building a movement, and we need to be moving, and we need to remember the words of our beloved, honorable ancestor, Frederick Douglass, who said, "Power concedes nothing without demand." We've got to demand this fair and better treatment for thousands of men and women who are held captive in the DOC. I thank you for what you have done. Let us move forward. On the move, long live John Africa, let us win. From Imprisoned Nation, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. American news media, tired of performing its usual duty, you know, telling the news, has launched a new form, reporting rumors and launching interminable discussions. Instead of the usual media icon of a talking head, they brought in talking heads, more mouths to discuss more and more nonsense. But that's not all. Their other new gig, micromanaging political campaigns. When's the last time you heard questions like, "Well, what does candidate A have to do to please X constituency?" I mean, what? Whatever happened to "this happened" or "that happened" or "this is why that happened"? News has become endless discussion over minutiae. Reports on people's feelings or the latest gadget that you just must have now. Or Hollywood gossip or what the prince or princess or duke of England is wearing. It is mindless and mind-bending. And every day, every hour, there's breaking news. How about just news? It is painful for me to watch or listen to news these days. Too much razzle-dazzle, not enough news. This is a nation of over 310 million people. There's more than enough stories to tell. Just tell them. There are some 7 billion people in the world today. That's more than enough stories to tell. There are over 2 million prisoners in America. That's more than enough stories to tell. Let's tell them.
from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is the best evidence that the 9/11 attacks constituted a crime of the U.S. state and not a sneak attack by foreign-based terrorists? Are elite elements deliberately promoting claims that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition in order to protect the true perpetrators? What gains have been achieved by investigators pursuing the physical evidence claims, and what are the prospects for meaningful action for justice? How significant was 9/11 and the truth movement from an independent media perspective? On the season's debut of the Global Research News Hour and on the occasion of the 15th anniversary of the event which launched the so-called War on Terrorism, we speak to three observers and analysts who offered their perspectives on 9/11, the truth movement, and what gains, if any, have been made. We'll be joined by writer and political activist Mark Rabinowitz, Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and with fellow independent journalist James Corbett of The Corbett Report. On this week's program, 9/11, 15 years later, Part 1, Best Evidence or PSYOP on Promoting WTC Controlled Demolition Claims. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 9th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Hillary is so irreparably tainted and unfit to serve, her key strategy is diverting attention from her wrongdoing two ways: bashing Trump beyond customary campaign jousting, and spreading misinformation and big lies about Russia, using the media as press agents to do her dirty work. Neocon Washington Post editors and staff one-sidedly support her. One of many examples of how low U.S. media scoundrels have sunk, transforming themselves into disgraceful laughingstocks. WaPo's latest anti-Russia harangue is claiming a potential covert plot to disrupt November elections. One unnamed U.S. source admitted America's intelligence community has no definitive proof or anything suggesting a Russian plot to manipulate or otherwise disrupt the nation's electoral process. So why is WaPo reporting rubbish, vicious Russia-bashing propaganda, while ignoring how America interferes in numerous elections abroad to assure officials in charge serve its interests? That comes from the article, Fabricated Claims About Russian Covert Plot to Disrupt U.S. Elections, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 8th. Many Kremlin officials preferred Ms. Clinton as a familiar face, while they viewed Mr. Trump as a dark horse. The pro-Western camp within the Kremlin walls, yes, it exists and is quite strong, tried to build bridges with Clinton campaign using Ms. Elizaveta Osetinskaya of RBC as their envoy in Washington. However, the violently anti-Russian propaganda churned by Clinton's campaign and by Hillary personally changed the mood in Moscow. Anti-Russian hysteria of such magnitude has not been seen even at the height of the Cold War in the Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan era, notably Republican politicians. The campaign against Putin's Russia mirrors the campaign against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and we remember that newspaper columns were followed by columns of tanks. That comes from the article, A Lousy Dancer, Putin's Getting Blamed for All of Hillary's Problems, by Israel Shamir, posted September 8th, originally appearing in the UNZ Review. Although Vladimir Putin and the Russian leadership will try to work with Clinton in a bid to reduce tensions, her close relationship with the neocons and her warmongering attitude would most probably drive the world towards war. In 2014, when referring to the Ukrainian conflict, Killery actually compared Putin to Hitler in one of the most disrespectful and ludicrous remarks that a Western politician has made in recent years. It becomes even more absurd when you consider the fact that the West overthrew the Ukrainian government using and supporting neo-Nazis in the process. A Clinton administration staffed with neocons and war hawks would continue the policy of encircling Russia and of putting missile facilities in Eastern Europe, with tensions between NATO and Russia already great. The last thing the world needs is a Killery administration. That comes from the article, Hillary Clinton, a neocon and a war hawk. Would the world survive a Killery presidency? By Stephen McMillan, posted September 8th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Last year, high officials from Washington had tried to sabotage the launch of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, but failed to do so. In fact, countries that had formerly declared their allegiance to the U.S. government, namely Germany, France, Italy, UK, had, at the end of the day, taken the decision to join the new multilateral lending institution promoted by Beijing. President Barack Obama could not imagine that the AIIB would have got the support of more than 50 countries within a few months. Without a doubt, China is accelerating U.S. decline across the globe. In April 2015, Larry Summers, former Secretary of Treasury under Bill Clinton, declared that the successful call made by the AIIB represented the most dreadful blow to the U.S. hegemony. That comes from the article, China Challenges U.S. Dollar Hegemony, Seeks New Global Financial Order, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted September 8th. Speaking in Laos, Turnbull's prognostication was grim. Quote, as Daesh comes under more and more pressure on the battlefield in Syria and in Iraq, as it is rolled back, as its territory is being taken back, it will resort to terrorist activities outside of the Middle East. Unquote. ABC News, September 7th. The Turnbull government has already demonstrated that speculation is a far better milch cow in the making of security policy than evident threat. It promises police state measures, extensive detention periods for those convicted of terrorist charges, even the flimsier ones. Assessing intelligence generally demands dull, hallucinatory-free sobriety, the reactionary posture, all the hallucinatory visions needed. That comes from the article, Islamic State, Lone Wolf Attacks, and Australia, The Value of False Expectations, by Binoy Campmark, posted September 8th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Sunday, September 11th, marks a major milestone, 15 years since the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. A movement known today as 9/11 Truth started to take off almost immediately, with figures such as Michelle Chosadovsky, Michael Rupert, Barry Zwicker, and others gaining prominence as putting forward the counter-narrative that 9/11 was not a sneak attack but deliberately allowed, if not made, to happen on purpose, so as to provide a pretext for invasions of the Middle East and an intensified police state apparatus at home. The movement gained currency mostly on the internet at first. The movement broke through public consciousness in the wake of the release of the 2005 film Loose Change, which skyrocketed to 4 million views within 4 months and started to gain major media exposure on U.S. and European television stations. Among the claims brought forward as definitive proof the attacks were fabricated are evidence of controlled demolition of the Twin Towers, as well as the sudden collapse in the late afternoon of September 11th of World Trade Center Building 7, which was not hit by an airplane. The movement has unfortunately been marginalized in mainstream media and political consciousness, reducing it to virtual ineffectiveness as a tool against state oppression and militarism. There have been figures, however, who embrace the false flag explanation of the attacks but reject the cold, controlled demolition thesis, both for evidential and for strategic reasons. One of these is Mark Rabinowitz. Mark Rabinowitz has been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner for over 3 decades. He's the author of Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, An Uncensored Guide to Earth, Energy, and Money. He is also publisher of a fascinating website, oilempire.us, a political map to connect the dots between resource wars, ecological limits, and deep state events like 9/11 and the JFK assassination. He joins us from Eugene, Oregon. Mark Rabinowitz, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thanks again for the invitation.
The controlled demolition hypothesis seems to be such a dominant aspect of 9/11 truth these days. A lot of people point in particular to the collapse of Building 7 as the smoking gun. The collapse was symmetrical. It looked like a controlled demolition. It was not hit by an airplane. Fires have never caused a steel frame skyscraper to collapse like this. And, you know, you're probably familiar with some of the key talking points there. So I'm wondering if you could, I mean, I want to get into the strategic arguments in a minute, but In terms of the evidentiary analysis, what for you are the most important arguments that refute the controlled demolition argument, if you could put that, you know, relatively briefly?
Well, I think those who allowed 9/11 to happen probably understood that flying planes into the towers would bring the towers down. It's fortunate, in a way, that the towers stood up long enough to allow most of the people below the impacts to escape with their lives. If the towers had collapsed on impact, 9/11 would have been even worse than it was. In terms of Building 7, it certainly looks like a demolition, but one of the towers gouged a multi-story hole on the side of it, which the firefighters watched all afternoon and became concerned that the building was going to come down. They put transits, a form of survey equipment, on the towers and Building 7 and watched them buckle and lean before they collapsed, which is not demolition. Now, you mentioned Mike Rupert in your introduction. He published from the Wilderness website and Crossing the Rubicon, which is one of the very best books on the evidentiary details of 9/11. And he and his effort, which I wrote for a couple times, did not touch at all the issue of demolitions or alleged claims that missiles were flown into the buildings, but instead looked at how warnings that the attacks were about to happen were deliberately suppressed at the highest levels of the Bush-Cheney administration, and how war game exercises simulating the actual events were used to distract and confuse the air defenses until the attacks had concluded. From an evidentiary standpoint, it would make more sense to put the perpetrators and enablers on the defensive rather than a ragtag group of investigators on the Internet who lack subpoena power, who lack really any evidentiary expertise on this in many cases, and instead focus on the deliberate lies of the government and the 9/11 Commission about why the attacks were allowed to happen and why rank-and-file agents at the FBI and CIA were actually blocked from stopping the attacks.
So I guess, I mean, you're saying that even if the claims of controlled demolition turned out to be true and there was weightier evidence, you and Rupert and others would still recommend against pursuing that line of argument as part of a strategy to confront the crime?
Well, first, the firefighters who were there are pretty clear that they don't believe this at all. I wasn't there. They were. They measured the buildings buckling and leaning. Most of the truthers did not. But arguing over that type of evidence reminds me of people who want to spend their time looking at the JFK assassination by focusing on how many bullets were fired and from what direction, when the real issue is why, not how. You can get lost in microanalyzing the evidence, and some people with the JFK research have done that for decades, and it has still not changed U.S. militaristic policy towards the type of peaceful transition that JFK was promoting. So if you want to spend your time focusing on the micro details of how the buildings collapsed, you know, I'm afraid that's going to be the same thing as with JFK. People will spend the next couple decades doing this, and meanwhile, we'll have endless warfare that makes the whole topic moot.
Let's stay with that JFK parallel for a second. I mean, could you talk more about how the investigation itself was, I mean, derailed? You're saying there was too much of a focus on the how and not the why, right?
Well, the early critics of the Warren Commission focused a lot on debunking the claim that three bullets were fired at John Kennedy. And I don't mean to rehash that. I assume most of your listeners know that is a lie. But the real issue is, what was Kennedy trying to do that got him removed from office? He was trying to turn off the Cold War. He had signed an order to withdraw U.S. troops from Vietnam. He was trying to turn off the nuclear arms race. And then, if you really want to get into it, there were other policies in Africa and Asia that he was trying to shift. I mean, what would the world be today if the Cold War had ended around 1965, as he and Khrushchev were trying to accomplish? How would we have used the resources for endless war for our collective survival as a species, as a civilization? That's the real issue with JFK, not whether it was four bullets or seven bullets that were fired in Dealey Plaza, or which direction they came from. As John Judge, one of the best JFK researchers, said, when he was asked which direction the bullets came from, he said they came from Washington.
Now, in both cases, though, it does seem as if the public's imagination is triggered more by the footage of Kennedy being shot from the front rather than from the back where Lee Harvey Oswald was firing. And similarly, this collapse of World Trade Center 7, that seems to grab people's attention more than these details about who might have had the motive and those sorts of arguments. So I don't know, is that the fact that there seems to be an easier ability to reach a wider audience by focusing on those sorts of more dramatic photographic and sorts of arguments than with these sorts of the nitty gritty types of points that you're raising? That's something that I guess the state, the deep state, counts on.
Well, you are doing radio and not television, and television is more popular in our culture than radio. But the difference between the collapse of the towers and the Zapruder film showing Kennedy being shot from the front is there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever about the fact that Kennedy was shot from the front, that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't firing at him, and that more than three bullets were fired. Whereas with the collapse of the towers, that's a much more complex topic, and in any evidentiary legal issue, the judge will usually give the state's expert witnesses the benefit of the doubt. Whether it's on this type of issue or something smaller, the official story starts off ahead of any challenger. And from a legal standpoint, let alone a factual standpoint, you have to have ironclad proof, not speculation. And meanwhile, we have the failure to do standard operating procedure when we heard that the attacks were underway for the government. You have 15 countries, if not more, that warned the Cheney White House that the attacks were about to happen. You have rank-and-file agents in the federal government who tried to stop it. You have a massive cover-up afterward. And once you have these established, which we had established pretty soon after the attack, the rest is detail.
So, yeah, you're getting at what you consider the best evidence that could be brought forward, and that has to do with the suppression of warnings. Maybe you should just give us a couple of examples when you're talking about government operatives and key officials and their ability to block and sabotage normal operating procedures, which would have and should have prevented the attacks. Just speak to the solidity of those claims.
Well, my favorite resource for this is called the Complete 9/11 Timeline, which was compiled by group of people, including Paul Thompson, who was one of the earliest researchers. And it goes into more detail on this than almost anybody would ever want. A couple of my favorite nuggets is you had the FBI agents in Minnesota who arrested one of the potential hijackers a couple of weeks before the attacks, Mr. Moussaoui was his name. And he was arrested at the flight school that he was training at. And the flight school had actually called the FBI, warning that they were concerned that he wanted to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. So he was arrested. He was a French national. And the French secret police said, oh, yeah, they knew him, and he was bad news, and he'd been to Afghanistan and all the rest. The FBI agents in the field tried to get a warrant to look at his computer and were overruled by senior management in Washington. After the attacks, they looked at his computer and found all sorts of incriminating material. And if they had looked at the computer beforehand, the attacks could not have happened. That's obstruction of justice. That's a felony in the United States. And it was never, not so much investigated, but there needs to be accountability. One of the officials who was involved in suppressing that got a pay increase. And the Colin Rowley, one of the agents in the field, she wasn't at the FBI long after that, even though she got a lot of public praise for trying to do her job. Now, for the FBI to be concerned about this, not getting a warrant for someone who wants to commit mass murder, now that's not their normal behavior. That's obstruction. You had foreign countries, including most of America's allies, provide warnings, some of them very specific, about who, what, where the attacks were going to be. Some of the warnings were very specific. Some were less so. There are probably other warnings that have not been made public. Most of them were completely ignored in the 9/11 Commission.
Now, I want to get to, there's an article you sent me. It was written by Emmanuel Sferios on the occasion of the fifth anniversary of 9/11. And just an excerpt from the intro. One lesson the shadow government has learned over the last 40 years is that the best way to defeat your opposition is to become your opposition. And like many of those phony socialist and anti-war groups on college campuses that suck rebellious student energy and dissipate it ineffectively, preventing the formation of a legitimate, effective opposition, So have they taken over a large part of the 9/11 truth movement itself, channeling new skeptics and old into endless debates about physical evidence and other ineffective actions. I'm wondering if you could tell us, Mark, are there any indications in your mind that the diversion of the investigation towards controlled demolition theories and other physical evidence claims is part of a deliberate psychological operation and not simply an unfortunate happenstance by naive investigators?
Well, it's a mix of the two. My favorite example of that is actually the claim that a missile was fired at the Pentagon and not actually Flight 77. This claim was first made public by U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about a month after the attacks. And I don't think anyone needs to question what Donald Rumsfeld's motivations were, that he was not a trustworthy individual, to put it politely. Now, that does not mean that everyone who has echoed this is doing it maliciously. When I first looked at the claim, I found it intriguing and almost believed it, and then realized, oh, this is not actually correct. But as a hoax, it had a lot of traction for discrediting the idea of foreknowledge in the Washington, D.C. area, since hundreds of people saw the plane crash and hundreds more picked rubble and luggage and bodies out of the site. In the first couple of years of the 9/11 truth movement, there was very little focus on demolition as a primary claim. Most of the focus was on the suppressed warnings, the stand down of the air defense, and the war games that simulated the actual events. I mean, why was the Central Intelligence Agency doing a plane into building exercise near Dulles Airport at one of the main intelligence agency headquarters, the National Reconnaissance Office, which runs the spy satellites? That is not in the 9/11 Commission report. It was in the media, it was in the media, in the Associated Press, but it wasn't in the 9/11 Commission report. If it's who scheduled a plane into building exercise at the exact time that the planes turned around toward their targets. That deserves an investigation. It certainly deserves attention. There's also the issue of what's called ALEC station, A-L-E-C, Alex Station was the CIA's office that was set up to stop bin Laden and his group. And they refused to share their information about the hijackers being in the country with the FBI, the Domestic Intelligence Agency of the United States. Again, that was also not in the 9/11 Commission report. If we ever had a real investigation, which doesn't seem likely, Alex Station would be a good place to start.
So I just only have a couple more minutes left. On the occasion of this 15th anniversary of 9/11, we've got there's a presidential election looming in a couple of months. I'm wondering what you would suggest we make of all of this conjecture as the human family forges ahead into an uncertain future where perhaps more deep state events loom.
It would be nice to think that 9/11 would be the last deep crime of state. But unfortunately, as long as the distractions and diversions can keep people preoccupied, as long as most people don't want to see how these things work, it's likely we will continue to have more and more of these types of events. And the real goal is not to have necessarily a new investigation, since that seems about as likely as a new investigation of the JFK assassination, but to be able to transform the effort for world war towards global peace. We're at peak oil, we're at climate change, overpopulation, increasing tension all over the world, and the real issue is how to convert the war machines, not just of the United States, but we're number one for that, towards survival for humanity and the biosphere. Because if we don't do that, we're likely to collapse civilization. And I think subconsciously we all know that. And one of the aspects of 9/11 was to ensure endless warfare, and it's been very effective, unfortunately.
Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much. Mark Rabinowitz has been a writer, political activist, ecological campaigner, and permaculture practitioner. He's the author of Peak Choice, Cooperation or Collapse, An Uncensored Guide to Earth, Energy, and Money. His website is oilempire.us.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He is the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. AE911truth.org now registers 2,620 architects and engineers, all demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three WTC high-rises on 9/11. Richard Gage, it's a pleasure to have you back on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. It's my honor.
Richard, we have introduced you before in detail about the failures of the National Institute on Standards and Technology report to adequately explain the collapses. I was hoping you could just give us a very, very brief recap. So I'm just going to maybe appeal not only to your expertise as an architect with 28 years of experience in the field and who's researched this the attacks thoroughly, but also I'll be calling on your abilities as an auctioneer. Can you do it maybe 2 minutes or less, some of the main points that challenge the official narrative?
Well, yes, there is all of this evidence that NIST has not included in the reports. First of all, regarding the World Trade Center Building 7, while they were forced into acknowledging that this third tower that collapsed on 9/11 collapsed at free fall acceleration, they were embarrassed publicly into this, but they do not acknowledge the implications of that or the implications of the videos that show that it came down exactly like a classic controlled demolition. In fact, at free fall and in under 7 seconds. This symmetrical freefall collapse can only happen if all 80 columns are removed from this building. at once. That's the only way it happens. And, of course, that only happens by explosive demolition, like the old hotels, for instance, in Las Vegas. And there's evidence of incendiaries, molten iron, molten steel, documented by official sources, by FEMA, which actually that metallurgical examination, which proves incendiary, was removed from the final report that came out by NIST 7 years later that blames the collapse of this building, this 47-story steel-frame building, by normal office fires. And so, of course, just on the face of it, it's absurd. And every architect and engineer we talked to, 2,700 of them, now have signed our petition demanding a new investigation. And so that's the nutshell version for Building 7. With respect to the Twin Towers, we have evidence of incendiaries, not only in the pools of molten iron underneath in the basements of both Twin Towers, but in the billions of iron microspheres found by the USGS and R.J. Lee, an environmental consulting firm, throughout the World Trade Center dust. And this is absolutely a direct explanation by way of incendiaries, as well as the explosive demolition of these buildings, hurling 4-ton structural steel sections laterally in every direction, landing 600 feet away, 60 miles an hour. These sections are shot out of the towers, trailing thick white smoke clouds, which is also indicative of thermite, which would have to have been removing the core columns as well in order to bring each of these buildings symmetrically down in under 12 seconds, shattering the structural steel frames of each of them completely from top to bottom.
Okay, well, that's very good. I just wanted to bring up a couple of points because my other guest, who's has some skepticism about the controlled demolition hypothesis, brings up a point, and I'm not sure this is something that you've acknowledged, but there were reports from firefighters on the scene who claimed to have seen buckling on the southwest corner between floors 10 and 13 early on, and that there was tremendous damage from falling debris from the North Tower, which hit the south face of World Trade Center 7, Tower 7. And, of course, there was a gaping 20-story hole on there and heavy fires. And based on that and the creaking noises and stuff from named firefighters, they were on the scene saying, we've got to evacuate the area. And they were anticipating a collapse and that they started to clear the area around 4:30, just before the building did collapse. So I'm just wondering if you are familiar with those details, and if that's maybe if that doesn't somehow contradict or any of the observations that you've raised.
No, none of those points contradict the evidence. The evidence. Those points do not show how this building could possibly have fallen after witnesses hear explosions. They describe the building, and we can see the building coming down in the videos, symmetrically, straight down, uniformly. So any buckling on the side on the 11th floor would have been an argument in favor of this building falling over, not straight down. That takes all 82 columns at once being removed from this building in order for it to fall straight down. In fact, the penthouse, main penthouse and screen wall falls directly straight down a half a second prior to the overall building, indicating that those core columns were removed all at once. And that's irrelevant then as to what damage from the North Tower may or may not have caused it. NIST even says, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress with explaining these collapses, they acknowledge that the damage from the North Tower was insignificant. They acknowledge that diesel fuel, which was another myth out there, was not a factor in this building's collapse. It came down, they say, due to normal office fires. Normal office fires have never brought down a skyscraper in the 100-year history of of skyscrapers and over 100 examples of very hot, large, and long-lasting fires, which have never brought one down. But controlled demolition has, in the exact manner as it did come down. And there's evidence of incendiaries, pools of molten iron, seen by the first responders, the structural engineer himself, Leslie Robertson, who suggests that there was a river of molten steel. Well, normal office fires can't create that. And this plane, this building was not hit by a plane. This is the third tower that came down.
Well, if after, there, sorry, if there were a, like, okay, so if you're arguing that explosives, only explosives could have generated the heat that would have not only created the molten metal, I mean, I don't know if it's aluminum or some other sort of substance, but that would have generated the heat necessary. But if that's the case, then these explosives would have had to have been planted like before the planes hit them, right?
Clearly, this takes months with dozens of operatives in an undercover operation. Perhaps at the time that Ace Elevator, who came out of nowhere to secure this largest elevator modernization in the world, and were in the Twin Towers with 85 employees when the planes hit the towers. So we certainly want an investigation of Ace Elevator. We certainly want an investigation of the security company, Stratasec, of Securicom, who had the contract for the security up until the day of 9/11, when their contract actually ended.
So if these explosives were planted in the building before the planes hit them, why wouldn't the plane crashes have set them off? I mean, these planes would have generated a lot of heat. You know, kinetic energy turns into heat energy, and why wouldn't that have set off those explosives?
I'm sure they did. There's probably fail safes that would keep such explosions or explosives from going off all throughout the building, because as we know the chain of explosions, which were heard by hundreds of witnesses, that did start the collapse of this building, happened 50 minutes to 90 minutes after the first plane hit the tower. So I'm sure there was some damage to those locally produced explosives, but that doesn't invalidate any of the evidence.
Okay. Which
we found. In fact, there's evidence of very high-tech nanothermite incendiaries found in all the World Trade Center dust samples by an independent team of scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. Red-gray chips, up to 10 tons of them by extrapolation, and four independently collected samples, they find that this is a very high-tech form of nanothermite developed only by the most sophisticated advanced defense contracting laboratories. That's in a peer-reviewed paper, the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal, called Thermitic Materials in the World Trade Center Dust. It shouldn't be there.
Okay, Richard, you've done a tremendous amount. Like, it's been a decade, as I said at the outset, since your eyes were opened, as it were. So I'm wondering, beyond this awareness raising with the tours and the videos and the media appearances, what in practical terms have you and other people in this movement done in the last 10 years to confront the authorities that, as you're saying, had the means, motive, and opportunity to make it happen on purpose?
Well, early on, we submitted a request for a correction to NIST with their fraudulent building reports for all three towers, forcing them to reply and say that, we found no evidence for explosives, but then they acknowledge in writing due to a response to a FOIA request that they never looked for evidence of explosives or incendiaries. After lying and saying implying that they did look for them earlier, I forgot what I was going to say next.
Okay. Well, could you talk about some of the other efforts that you've taken order to confront the powers that be?
Yeah. Thanks. Sorry. We've gone to. We're in a lawsuit against NIST as well right now to get them to release more information. We've gone to. We've given our DVD and our petition when we reached 1,000, and then 2,000 members calling for a new investigation, architects and engineers, to every member of Congress. We've gone to all of the media again and again on an annual basis. We've gone to 10 different annual and regional conferences of the American Institute of Architects and the Structural Engineering Society and had booths where we show the evidence. We show Building 7 come down. We say, did you look at this? Did you know about this third tower? They say no. We say, well, what does it look like to you? They say controlled demolition. I'm talking hundreds and hundreds and by now thousands of architects and engineers who we confronted directly one-on-one at these events. And they say, yeah, it's a controlled demolition. And we go, did you know it came down on 9/11? No, no way. And so they didn't know about the third worst structural failure in modern history. That is World Trade Center Building 7. We educate them about it. They end up signing our petition. And we're going to have 1,000 co-sponsors for a resolution at the annual business meeting on the floor of the American Institute of Architects' next convention in Orlando, calling upon the AIA to call for a new investigation.
So if you're talking, if you're talking about a new investigation, like who there, there's already been an investigation into 9/11, that which is, you know, ipso facto flawed. But there, it seems to me that because 9/11 was 15 years ago, you know, most university aged students today were barely out of diapers when 9/11 happened, and so I'm wondering if we couldn't get an authentic investigation when the wound was fresh, what are the chances we're going to be able to pressure such an investigation now when there's so many other, you know, things happening on the world scene with ISIS and, you know, the other, you know, climate change and some of the other things that, well, are pressing down?
Awareness is growing among the American people in particular. Half the people now almost are aware of Building 7. I don't know why the architects and engineers aren't, but more people are becoming aware of it because of the work of the millions in the 9/11 grassroots movement. There's increasing pressure. So it's building. It's important. It's not a history. 15 years later, we're still governed, impacted severely by the $4.5 trillion global war on terror, which started as a result of 9/11. If there's any question about 9/11, we have to uncover it, the truth about what really happened on that day. Because obviously the implications of the controlled demolition of this building, these buildings are deep and severe and impact all of us. And I can understand why there's a reluctance to look at it even 15 years later. But we have to, and I believe we are making progress. And this conference that we're putting on in New York at the Cooper Union is direct evidence of that. We have 800 seats in the Cooper Union on September 10th and 11th, Saturday and Sunday. And we have a whole a dozen attorneys, including one of the most famous public advocate attorneys, Daniel Sheehan, with the Pentagon Papers, the Iran-Contra affair, the Karen Silkwood case. He's coming out on 9/11. He's talking about how to get this evidence into the court system, as is Judge Ferdinando Impassimato, the honorary president of the Supreme Court of Italy. He's coming and talking about how to get this evidence into the world court system. William Pepper, who's a famous attorney for the Martin Luther King case and the killing of Robert Kennedy, that case, he's emceeing the whole event on Sunday, which is a legal effort in the pursuit of justice. On Saturday, Mark Crispin Miller, famous journalist, is emceeing the whole affair with guest speakers such as Wayne Mattson and J. Michael Springman, who expose the roots of ISIS and the deep state. We have an incredible conference coming up, which is going to launch this new Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry onto the 9/11 Truth Movement scene, as well as the Truth Action Project, or TAP, 9/11 TAP, an effort to organize locally hundreds of grassroots organizations dedicated to getting the truth out about 9/11 and impacting Congress and the media.
Conventional wisdom says that you turn to mainstream media to get your information. How have you been? Have you seen any kind of? How is the trajectory in terms of the mainstream media coverage of this issue? Are you satisfied that there's any progress, or are things becoming more subverted? How do you gauge the way mainstream media has progressed on capturing this situation?
There seems to be some progress. We have a 45-minute interview on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, which became their number one viewed video ever. And on the dark side, we have not been invited back for some reason. These people get talked to. We've learned that 90% of the mainstream media is owned by just six corporations. We've learned that those six corporations are controlled in turn by boards of directorates that are cross-linked to those corporations in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry. That's who controls our media. So we're certainly not surprised to be censored. The truth about 9/11 and the truth about many other important topics in our society today.
Richard Gage, appreciate your coming on the show with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Richard Gage, AIA, is the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and as you just mentioned, he's speaking at the Justice in Focus event happening this September 10th and 11th in New York City. For details, please visit www.911justiceinfocus.org. James Corbett is the host and producer of The Corbett Report, an independent, listener-supported alternative news source which operates on the principle of open-source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about groundbreaking news and analysis on topics ranging from 9/11 and false flag terror to eugenics to the central bank fraud to geopolitics and more. He joins us now from Japan, where he is based. So thank you very much for joining us, James Corbett.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Now, for myself, it's the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and for me, my involvement in independent media, I would say, largely began with 9/11 because I saw so many of these, through my investigations on the internet, I saw so much that was just not being discussed, even in a lot of the conventional alternative media, and so I just felt compelled to go out and distribute the things that I was finding, leaflets and DVDs and even hosting a couple of film screenings at a public theater. And that led me into becoming a broadcaster at my community radio station and ultimately the podcasts I do with Global Research. And I was just curious to know, because you're doing a lot of this beyond the pale reporting on 9/11 and all these other subjects. I'm wondering what role 9/11 in particular had as an influence to your own work.
Well, I think my story sounds very similar to yours in that I was also, I think, drawn to the idea of alternative media and what could be accomplished through the independence offered by the internet because of the types of things that were not being reported on. 9/11 was the foundational event, but on a number of other issues. But certainly 9/11 was a core event for me. It was the first one that I really started researching on my own and that I started to get into and started to notice the discrepancies between what was being portrayed in the mainstream media and even, as you say, a lot of the conventional alternative media and what I was encountering online, the information I was able to dig up on, again, documentable, verifiable information about Osama bin Laden and the CIA in the 1980s or the Operation Northwoods plan or things like that, that start to ring alarm bells when it comes to 9/11 and was not being portrayed anywhere. And the internet offered that outlet through which ordinary people can reach out to tens, hundreds, thousands, occasionally millions of people around the world. It is truly a phenomenal time to be alive in that respect. So I knew I was compelled to do something. And within a few months, really, of starting along the investigative trail, I was already thinking about starting a website, something that I had never even contemplated before in my life.
Yeah, myself as well. I had not really thought seriously about getting into broadcasting or journalism until I went onto the internet and saw, you know, this all of these very well-defended positions that were being put out by superior writers. I mean, people like Michelle Chosadovsky, for example. James, what would you say then would have been the impact of 9/11 and 9/11 truth on media at large, you know, not just mainstream, but alternative media? Have we seen any sorts of impact or on the way people consume media?
I think that would come down more to the individual level. Certainly when we look at the mainstream media and how it has been affected by 9/11 or 9/11 truth, I think the only thing that we can conclude is that 9/11 truth is a perfect gateway for people who don't see the control of the media or how the media discourse is very tightly narrowed down to a very well-defined spectrum of allowable opinion. People who have difficulty seeing that can see it very clearly on issues like 9/11, especially when they've looked into various aspects of 9/11 truth and found some of the stunning, really truly remarkable information that's out there that one really has to dig around on the internet, usually through alternative independent media, in order to find. And I think that shows in a quite crystal clear manner that this is certainly not something that's going to be televised. The revolution will not be televised, as they say. So I think that's the perspective we have for the mainstream media. And as you say, the conventional foundation-funded alternative media, in quotation marks, that won't go near subjects like this or tend to denigrate them along with the MSM, I think also shows that there is a large degree of control of allowable opinion, even within the so-called dissenting voices out there, something that should not be unfamiliar to people, for example, who are familiar with Noam Chomsky's idea of manufacturing dissent and allowing certain acceptable forms of critique in order to obscure the real critique. And interestingly enough, of course, Noam Chomsky is another one of those people who say, don't look into 9/11, it's not worth your time. Make of that what you will. But I think that this issue exposes what can be seen as real independent media versus establishment media of various sorts, even ones that are conventionally thought of as alternative media. And so we see that 9/11 truth has ultimately flowered and reached fruition as an internet-based movement primarily. And that's interesting because it may be the first real independent alternative media movement that has arisen, did arise around this 9/11 truth issue. And that speaks to the at least potential power of alternative and independent media, which has, I think, truly influenced the public consciousness on events like these, where when I was starting 10 years ago, the idea of false flag terrorism, let alone the concept, was completely foreign to the vast majority of the population. Most people, when confronted with the idea, would say, why would the government attack itself? We've reached the point where not only is it now a much more well-understood phenomenon, but even mainstream media has to, in the wake of many of these events that are coming along, has to question, is this a false flag event? And of course they will usually answer no, but at least that idea is now au courant. And I noticed that in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, for example, it was a Yahoo News headline, was the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag event? That's a pretty remarkable shift in public consciousness. And I think that has been accomplished solely and specifically through this internet-based movement.
You've also got a new series of videos coming out just over the past week, I've noticed. I think there's four. It's called 9/11 Suspects. And I was wondering if you could maybe give us a bit of a brief breakdown of who these people are and why they're there, because as far as I can tell, they don't look like the photographs of the hijackers that I've seen.
Certainly not. The concept behind this series is that these are not people that I think are the kingpins or masterminds behind 9/11, but people who I think any real criminal investigation of what occurred on 9/11 would begin with, would start looking at these people and the information that they were privy to and or that they were involved in, the events that they were involved in, and how that relates to what was happening on 9/11. So, for example, as a fairly non-controversial example, Christine Todd Whitman, who was the EPA administrator on 9/11, who in the days and weeks following the events of September 11th repeatedly issued assurances that the air was safe to breathe in Lower Manhattan. It's okay. You don't need a respirator. To be fair, the EPA did say that first responders on the pile, on the actual ground zero designated area, should wear respirators. But other than that, they actually discouraged people in Lower Manhattan generally from wearing respirators and encouraged people to return to work. Encouragement that we now know is having health effects on a lot of people, of course, first responders, but also residents of Manhattan and Brooklyn, who ended up trying to sue Christine Todd Whitman. And that court case proceeded in 2006 when a federal district court judge ruled that Christine Todd Whitman and the EPA's reassurances actually contributed to the danger. Those reassurances were conscience shocking, but that was overturned a couple of years later by a panel of judges that decided that her federal immunity kicked in here, that she couldn't be prosecuted for this. So that's an example that probably a lot of people have heard of in some respect or other, the air is safe to breathe lie that is still killing first responders and others who are dying of the 9/11 cancers. But beyond that, people like Rudy Giuliani, who of course was mayor of on 9/11 and presided over the destruction of the crime scene. He was also given some type of warning about the collapse of the buildings before the buildings collapsed, a warning that was not passed on to the first responders. Of course, over 300 firefighters dying in the collapses of those buildings. We have people like Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, who controlled that commission from top to bottom in terms of everything, the scope of investigation, the people to be questioned, the lines of question to be given them, the shape and outcome of the final report. And this man was deeply tied into the Bush administration, having co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice and been on the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, deeply tied into the Bush administration that he was supposedly investigating. So certainly someone that you would look into in terms of the cover-up of 9/11. People like Robert Baer, a career intelligence officer with the CIA, who is well known. He appears on TV and talking about intelligence matters. He has a Time magazine column about intelligence matters, who a few years ago said, "I know the guy who cashed out the day before 9/11. He may have been lying about that, but at any rate, I think that would be worthy of further investigation. Strangely enough, he's never been questioned about those comments. So these are the types of people that I think a real criminal investigation of 9/11 would really start to look into. And that's the impetus behind the 9/11 suspect series.
With more to come, no doubt. James Corbett, I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing these thoughts with us on this pivotal anniversary.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with James Corbett. He is the producer and host of The Corbett Report. You can find his videos at CorbettReport.com and on the Corbett Report YouTube channel. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.